meeting today.
Meeting to order. And Mike, you're standing up. You can just move over towards the mic.
All right. Thank you.
Just go ahead and introduce yourself, Mike, and do whatever you want.
First off, my name is Mike Wendell. I'm Mayor of Prineville, and thank you all for coming to Prineville. A few of you that were here earlier got a tour of our new facility, and if you'd like afterwards, I'll give you give the rest of you the tour of our new City Hall. As you know, we made sure that we had some of Prineville's finest wallpaper incorporated into our building, typical for Prineville. So we're still going through the a few little glitches in our building, so thank you very much. It's a great facility, and we're very happy to have it. First off, if you need anything, please let me know. We'll make sure we get you whatever you need. The only downside is that after last fall, the governor was here, and I'm complete out of my get-out-of-jail-free cards after he's left. So I can't help you there. But anything else, please let me know, okay? I want to talk to you just for a few minutes about growth. Prineville and Crook County are currently or just recently have been designated as the fastest growing county in the state of Oregon. We're dealing with some humongous growth in the city and in the county here. With that growth, transportation is a humongous part of that. Infrastructure is a humongous part. Annexation is also a very large part. One of the things we most recently did is we looked at all our islands that we had, the so-called islands that we have inside the city, went through a public process, public hearing process, and at the end of that we were able to annex all those islands into the city. So as of today, I'd have to check with the planning department, but I'm pretty sure as of today we don't have any islands in the city of Prineville, so we're pretty happy to do that. Also, we have put in our plans in the future that our intent is to not form any more islands in the city that are inside the UGB. I truly believe that if you're inside the UGB, one of the things you need to realize that sooner or later you probably will be annexed into the city. So I was very happy to see us try and stay away from having any more islands in the future. So it's been a big benefit for us. Transportation is always a big issue for us, but I think transportation is a big issue for everybody. It's just the way it is. Never seems to be enough money, is there? I don't think there's ever enough money to go around for transportation dollars. So we've done everything we possibly can to try and alleviate some of the costs. You know, as SDC, system development charges, are just not quite enough to pay for all those new roads that we need. So we've been very creative in looking at our infrastructure, and I think we're very proactive as far as trying to put in roads where we need to put them in and plan for the future. You know, our UGB is built for 20 years. Our transportation system plan should be built for 20 years, and we should live by that. So we're trying very hard. It's been some tough choices, some tough decisions. We've had to look at some very tough pieces of property, but we're looking as a whole for transportation, as a whole for the city of Prineville. We just currently purchased one piece of property that we believe that will alleviate possibly up to one-third of the traffic on 3rd Street going through town just by that one piece of property. So that was a big piece for us. Other things with growth, of course, as you know, annexation is always a big issue. I'm sure you probably get tired of listening to annexation issues after a while, but that's what you like to do, I'm sure, right? Everybody likes to deal with annexation issues. One step back, I want to talk one more thing about annexation. One of our pieces of property that we had to deal with annexation was Les Schwab's, as you know, the largest employer here and one of the great employers of the state of Oregon. Beforehand, we actually talked to Les Schwab's Corporation and discussed what annexation would do for them and what it would do for the community. When we went through the public process of annexing in the islands, they were one of them, and they did not contest being annexed into the city. I think that really shows you some foresight from the city's point to make sure that we involve them in the communication process and that they were not opposed to annexation. I believe other communities can look at what we have done with some of our large employers and can follow suit by just making simple communications. All you have to do is just make a phone call and you'd be amazed what can happen. All right, for that, I would just like to say thank you and, again, welcome to Prineville.
Thanks, Mike. Hold off for just a minute. I've got to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Annexation is one of my major issues, so I was kind of curious about the sense of island annexation you're talking about. The annexation under 222750 was originally designed to deal with islands, that were two islands. You have a city and then you have a place there. Do you do much of things like doing cherry stem annexations of roads to create islands?
Mainly what we looked at, are you talking about the ones that we did or in the future? Mainly what we looked at is that the ones that are totally surrounded by residences in the city. We looked at some roads, but, that's sort of a, I don't know if that's really truly annexation at that point. I don't know if you're really forming an island at that point, you know. The ones we were really adamant about were the ones that were completely surrounded by neighbors that were in the city.
We'll be, I think, dealing with that particular issue in the next session. So it's quite useful. I don't think anybody objects to true island annexation where you really have completely surrounding, but we've had a little trouble with other kinds of various places, including the United States.
Oh, I'm sure. And you know, if the planning staff was here, they would probably be smacking me around a little bit, but that's okay. I get used to it after a while, so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Mike, I have one. You asked the ARB the point about deferred maintenance on roads, and he indicated generally that he was in good shape. How do you feel? How does your road department feel about, are they behind the curve? Or are they kind of where they belong?
Well, give me one second here. All right, they're not here right now. I'll take it.
We're not arguing again.
Just like I said earlier, just about every road department you're going to deal with, I think, throughout the whole state and through every state in the nation, there's just not enough money. There's never enough money. SDCs are great for transportation dollars, but they just won't cover the costs. Sure, it would be great if we had some more money, but we're dealing the best we can with what we can. I think our public works department, our road department, does everything they can to try and maintain the roads that they have with the resources we have. It's always a tough issue, but we're being as creative as we possibly can in that type of work. But, you know, to be totally honest with you, at the end of the year or at the end of the summer, you always run just a little bit short of enough new paving dollars. So, but we're doing everything we can. I think one of the big issues we run in with is as we grow, is there enough transportation dollars to grow with us? And that's always a big issue, you know. You don't realize, but a lot of times we don't realize as a public body is that it's not just the streets that we have to maintain. It's the curbs and all that type of stuff. You know, it's a humongous infrastructure. And as those things wear down, they cost us more money. So.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Uh-huh.
I want to say to the public, we appreciate your attendance. With Eagle Point, I have to tell you that. There's more people here. There is a sign-up sheet over on the table for any of you that would like to testify. It'll be around 3 o'clock before we get to you, but any of you that want to say something to the committee are welcome. And I suppose we ought to introduce the committee. We have a great turnout. We have everybody but one. And then we have some interlopers. So, Paul, do you want to start? Yeah. Introduce yourself. Say how you're from.
As the first interloper?
Yeah.
I'm Paul Holby. I'm from the University of Crossland County. And I serve on the Economic Development in the House. I appreciate the chair allowing me to sit in on this committee. It's really important to the economy of our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gene Wisnett, and I traveled all the way from Sun River to Deschutes County, the adjacent county. And thank you for the invitation to participate today. I think the chair now is going to learn what we've been experiencing in Deschutes County for the last 10 years, the growth in his county that he represents here. So I'm sure that the chair will be working with Representative Burley and I on a lot of the high growth issues.
I'm Doug Witzep. I represent Senate District 28 in the Oregon Senate. I'm the Vice Chair of the Senate Transportation Committee. I'm always pleased to get back to Prineville. I grew up out in Powell Butte, so it's kind of like coming home.
Thank you, Senator.
Representative Burley, House District 54, the City of Bend, and I apologize for being late, but I'm not moving quite as fast right now as I usually do. It's a great turnout. Glad to see you all here, and hopefully this will be as informative for you as it certainly will be for us.
I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick. I represent House District 33, which is northwest Portland and about 20 miles west, including areas where annexation and transportation are the two major issues in my district.
I'm very happy to be here.
George Gilman, District 55, Lake and Perk County, northern half of Klamath County, and about a third of Jackson County. I happen to live in Jackson County, but I spent a lot of time over here because I love this country.
I'm Representative Alan Brown from House District 10. That's the Central Oregon Coast. I'm from Newport, and I've been, and still are, the manager and owner of the Leshwab Tire Center in Newport for 35 years. So I'm a little familiar with Prineville, especially that end of Prineville out there at the junction out there. I've been there a few times, and I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you for having me.
I'm Representative Terry Beyer. I represent House District 12, which is Springfield. I've managed to serve on transportation from my appointment in 2001, and love the committee. We've got to do a lot of fun things, had some great committees, and I'm really pleased to be here, and thank you for hosting us. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I actually live in Multnomah County. I represent East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and all of Hood River County. And transportation is a huge issue, as Representative Halsey said, and it's continuing to be. I live right on the edge of the growth. It's coming your way, guys. Highway 26 between Bend and Mount Hood is part of my district, and the I-84 corridor going up the gorge is my district. So, a huge issue, and I'm glad to be here, too. I love Prineville.
State Representative Carol Lynn Tomei, and I represent the city of Milwaukee and parts of southeast Portland. And transportation is certainly a big issue in my area, especially in Milwaukee. Our roads are really deteriorating, and we're looking at putting out a bond measure to help supply more funds to keep the roads up. If you don't keep them up, as I'm sure you know, then they deteriorate, and it costs many times more to rebuild the roads. So we're working on that. The other transportation issue that's important to us is mass transit, especially light rail coming into Milwaukee and through the Selwood area, Westmoreland area, which I also serve.
My name is Representative Dave Hunt. I represent mostly unincorporated Clackamas County, lots of annexation issues and transportation issues as well. Privileged to run this committee and be here. In my day job, I also work in maritime transportation, which is a key issue for a lot of cargo coming to and from this area out of the Columbia River.
Thank you. I'd also like to introduce the staff. Susan Jordan is from the Legislative Fiscal Office. She's the one that figures out how much money ODOT's got. Mike Rady from the Committee Assistant, and Janet Atkins, the Administrator, and my right and left hand person in this endeavor. Okay, let's talk about regional highway projects, short, long-term strategies, Central Oregon Area Commission on Transportation, Scott Cooper. How are you, Scott? Good to see you, Judge. Alan Under and Gary Farnsworth. You can go in the order I named or any order you wish.
Well, I'm Gary Farnsworth from ODOT. Is this one on?
Okay.
All right. And I am an area manager for ODOT in Region 4 out of the Bend office. I report to Bob Bryant, the Region 4 manager. And I also work with the Central Oregon Area Commission on Transportation. I am the area manager who is represented there. And I work very closely with both Scott Cooper, Judge Cooper here from Crook County, and also Mayor Alan Unger from the city of Redmond. And so I'm here to provide support to them during this time period, also to answer questions or to take notes here and research any questions you might have. So I'm basically going to turn it over to them. There is a handout coming around that does have a list of projects recently completed under construction and that are in our program in the STIP, kind of in the 2004-2009 time frame. For your reference, I wasn't planning on delving into that, but I'd be happy to answer questions. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Okay. Would you indicate in the chart?
Yes.
Over there, up against the wall, but up front, with the highway north side slowly.
Hello. Welcome to Crook County. I'm Scott Cooper, County Judge in Crook County. I was looking around the room, and I actually think I testified in front of almost every one of you on some committee or the other in the last session. So it's delightful to see my town, particularly Representative Gilman and Senator Witz, who represent our district, and then our neighbors, Representative Burley and Representative Wisnick. And then Mr. Greenlee, do you now continue to own your property in the south part of Crook County?
I had dirt covered from 1972 until 3 months ago.
A former constituent.
One of your fine citizens purchased the last 160 acres.
And a lot of people are, and of course, Representative Brown, we welcome you back to Prineville again. There's a lot going on in our little sleepy community, which isn't so little and isn't so sleepy anymore. And it's just a microcosm of what's going on in our entire Tri-County region, Jefferson and Deschutes counties. We had the opportunity a few weeks ago to have a lively, and that's my polite term, discussion with the Oregon Transportation Commission about what was happening and how we do planning for this region and how the state and the local governments engage with each other. We spent about 4 hours together over at the Deschutes Services Center and had a good hashing out of all of our issues. I think it's a bit illustrative of what we're dealing with, all of us, in trying to deal with something that we feel like is coming at us so fast that we're building the airplane as we go along. I brought along this chart just as one example. If you take a look at this, this is a milepost to milepost look at the transportation volumes from border to border along Highway 97. I don't have the 26 numbers because ODOT didn't have that chart, but the 97 one tells the whole story. Where those peaks start occurring is as you hit Madras, and where those peaks stop occurring is about La Pine. It flattens out underneath that. So we've got the bulk of the traffic that's headed up and down that corridor and trying to manage the freight into it, the freight out of it, the connections into it, the connections out of it. The Central Oregon traffic through our major cities is an ongoing challenge that the Central Oregon Area Transportation Commission, of which I'm currently chairing, is discussing at every one of our meetings. Some of the things that we are looking at as a group as far as regional coordination are we're now integrating the operations of the Metropolitan Planning Organization. For those of you who haven't checked lately, all of Deschutes County is now one metropolitan statistical area, so it gets its own MPO to do planning in that area and try and move that around, talking to our federal partners. Corridor plans on all of our major highways in and out. Might surprise you to know there are 5 state highways which intersect right here in Prineville. And this is just one community of the 7, which is in Central Oregon. Our regional planning initiative, trying to talk about how do we take our 7 cities and talk about connectivity between them. We have the highest commuting rate outside of Multnomah County between the counties of Central Oregon. It's about 1 in 5 in my community who are traveling every day to one of the other communities in order to go to work. You add to that the number of seniors who are driving to Bend for the world-class medical treatment center, which is over there, which is a great thing, but it adds more burden to the highways, the retail opportunities, recreational opportunities, the services which are shared among all of our communities. And we really have come to the conclusion on COAC that while we have 7 different communities, we really have 1 large urban center in a rural setting. Now, as that continues to infill, perhaps it'll become less rural than it is today. But as we try to adjust our planning focus, it's with the idea that we need to plan as if every community needs to be able to connect to every other community as if it were a large metropolitan area. That doesn't necessarily fit with the land use system, which assumes that every community will be individually self-sufficient and have all the services and workforce and housing that it needs. But we see that as very much what's happening, and we don't see that as changing anytime soon. And we are continuing down that line with a regional plan. We're having extensive discussions in all of our communities about the potentiality for expanding our transit system somewhat. Those are for the most part local, but they do also have a regional aspect. If we can gather up seniors who perhaps don't have the ability to drive anymore and put them in some sort of senior bus system, move them between the different hospitals and radiology centers and medical clinics out of the region, that would be a godsend to them. When you look at our projections for senior populations in the next 10 years and you realize we're going to be topping out around 28% of our population over the age of 60 within a decade, that is of great concern to us. We need to be able to efficiently move those people from one community to another. Our medical right brokerage, operated by Central Oregon and a governmental council, has come on gangbusters and is serving all of our communities, but the demand is certainly outstripping the supply at the moment. Freight, this is a huge issue for us. A lot of that traffic that's coming through the middle of Central Oregon down 97, these trucks which are headed border to border and don't particularly want to stop at the Dairy Queen on 97 in the middle of Bend. Their goal is to get through the city as fast as possible. And we know that a truck takes up about 3 car lengths at any given time. And so the faster that we are able to move them through the cities and around the cities, the better off our local commuters will be. Planning to do that is another issue altogether. Taking care of some of those trucks' needs by getting more of the truck onto rail has been a major project of the committee. The city of Prineville, I'm looking at numbers the other day, city of Prineville, when it took, started railing in the tires that Les Schwab was bringing into Central Oregon, removed something like, Mike's still there, 25,000. Thank you. Truck trips, just simply by picking that up. Well, that's obviously a huge impact on the highway, and we'd like to see more of that. Working with Class 1 railroads has been a challenge, to say the least. We're fortunate to have our own small short line owned by the city of Prineville here, and it is doing what it can to serve as a facilitator and accommodator for local freight needs to try and make that easier for the business community as well as for the commuting public. The issue of at-grade rail crossings remains a critical one for us. We're going to spend some more time on that in the year ahead. Clearly, with the number of cars we're putting on the highways, stopping them all for a 25-mile-an-hour train moving through the area is neither safe, prudent, nor a particularly efficient way to move freight. We are always cognizant, and this was an issue that we shared with OTC, of the fact that while all cities like to be viewed as equal, all partners at the table like to be viewed as equal, some are definitely more equal than others. We look at situations like Culver and Metolius are facing. They are seeing the residential and potential residential impact of not only the recreational traffic that's headed out toward Lake Village Chinook, but also the housing impact of the placement of a large state prison in the community of Madras, with a lot of residential housing accompanying it going in the outlying communities. Those communities are not in a position to expand their transportation systems to be able to meet the demand that they're currently experiencing, and it's going to take more than just local resources to be able to upgrade their local systems to deal with things that really are of statewide making. Likewise, if we get into it, as we get into this constrained funding environment, we're very concerned that if we adopt a policy at the state where you have to pay to play on the modernization game, you can't get dollars for making improvements unless you invest a standard 20% of the project, what we will see as a result of that is the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer, because not all of those communities are able to put the dollars in at the same level. We need to continue to have flexibility based on community ability to pay, based on what's going on as far as the numbers of people we have, the economies of scale, and the sheer volume of what's coming at them. The third point I would make is that we have become, apparently not necessarily by choice, but by other people's choice, Oregon's destination of choice. Everybody wants to come play in Oregon, or in Central Oregon. And while that has many positive sides to it, our revenue system in this state is not organized to recapture much of the benefit on the governmental side of all that play. So when everybody comes in to enjoy our wonderful sunshine and our lakes and our rivers, and they're coming over the state highways to do it, there's no more revenue necessarily being created for the local governments to sustain and maintain our pavement conditions or make, add additional passing lanes or anything else. So we continue to struggle with the fact that we are not keeping up with the current impact on either the state highways, the local system, or the district highways, given the volume that we are experiencing. How can you help as a committee? It basically comes down to four things. We need some serious attention paid in the upcoming legislative session to what are we going to do about funding modernization projects. We basically have mortgaged the future of our modernization projects to the point where we have about $11 million available region-wide to fund modernization projects in the 2009-2011 STIP in the whole Tri-County, in the whole Region 4. That's the border-to-border Central Oregon section. Now, the reason we don't have any money to pay for modernization projects is because the money that we would have had is now going to repay OTIA bonded debt. While OTIA was a much-needed injection of cash into system improvement, it doesn't alleviate the fact that the problems didn't go away and people didn't quit coming here. It just, we left that to figure it out another day, and we believe the another day is coming up in January 2007, and we're going to have to figure something out. Of secondary importance or equal importance is to preserve what we've got. And Gary and I were talking just before this meeting about the fact that our preservation project basically puts us into the critical stage in 2010. At this point, we can maintain up till then, but without more revenue coming into the system to maintain the pavement that's on the ground, we're going to start seeing literally some portions of road going back to near gravel or gravel stage on the state highway system. That's particularly important for the district-level highways. We spent so much time dealing with the main arterial, the 97s, the 26s. We've been robbing the maintenance budgets for the district-level highways that run out the O'Neill Highway that runs the back road along the Crooked River on the back road to Terrebonne, or the sisters to Bend Highway, or the road that runs up to Tumalo. Some of those are just not getting any attention. They're potholing, they're cracking, they're meat lining, and we are going to have to figure out some way to distribute dollars better. Do you have anything to add?
No.
Another critical point for us that we believe that this committee can do more about is providing statewide oversight to the inter-regional connection. We are very good at this state in planning the transportation system within the individual regions. Moving from one region to another, we hope the feds do it, and if the feds don't do it, we're not even sure it happens. My best example, and I've given it 10,000 times at COAC, is if you try and tell a foreign tourist how to get from the Portland Airport to Central Oregon. Now, stop and think about that. Tell somebody who speaks another language, we need you to go out of the airport, follow the signs, get yourself on 84, go down to the Wood Village exit, turn right, and when you get to the turn, U-Haul, turn left, and don't go past Madras because you've gone too far. That's about as good as it gets for our explanation from how to get to Portland to Central Oregon, yet this tourism is what's supposed to be replacing the timber economy of this community. If we're going to transition to a system which is dependent on all of those bodies and all of that freight that is coming into our area, making it from one part of the state to the other, we're going to have to make some investments in figuring out how to efficiently move through high-density areas like the Gresham area and how to sign it and how to explain it a little bit better than we've done in the past. What's the definition of insanity, doing things the way you've always done them and expecting a different result? That's rather the position we're finding ourselves in with the Oregon transportation system today. So we hope the committee will be able to maybe spend some quality brain trust time thinking about those interregional connections and how they might work a little bit better in the upcoming session. The last thing we would ask you to do is to continue to support important programs like ATIA and Connect Oregon. Our goal to best fund economic development is to have a system that allows people to move goods and people efficiently between any two points in the state. If you take a look at Southeast Washington and you take a look at Southeast Oregon, you might wonder why the economies of those two are so disparate. Southeast Washington seems to be thriving. Southeast Oregon is struggling a little bit. We all know that's where the pockets of lowest income in the state are currently located. The difference between them, quite frankly, is that there's a nice interstate leg that runs right down into Southeast Washington, and try and get beyond Prineville to Southeast Oregon to any of the communities down there. Transportation is economic development, and our ability to fund it is the future of this state. So we hope you'll be able to continue to look at those programs that you've so creatively funded in the past and continue to fund them in the future. Turn it over to Mayor Unger.
Well, thank you, Scott. Scott's such a good talker. As I was reading through, as he was talking, I was crossing stuff off. You don't need to hear it twice. Yes, I'm Alan Unger. I'm mayor of Redmond. I'm also chair of Central Oregon Cities Organization. We call it COCO. It's made up of the cities of Maupin, Mathis, Metolius, Culver, Prineville, Redmond, Sisters, and Bend. It was formed so that we in Central Oregon could talk to you with one voice, basically about water and transportation, which are really our main issues here. We also have Doug Riggs, who you see often in Salem, to help us with that, because we're elected officials just like you are, which means that we're volunteers, and it's difficult for us to get to Salem. And I will applaud you for the commitment that you make during a session to stay in those motels, to get up early, to stay there late. It's a job I wouldn't want, and I applaud you for doing. As Scott said, Central Oregon is one big community. We're cities, we're destination resorts, which are as big as cities. We're county subdivisions. Some are as big as cities, like Crooked River Ranch. And Measure 37 is going to create more of those and more impacts. People in cities, destination resorts, and subdivisions all work, shop, and play within separate communities. You see us like this chart shows that we're moving from one community to another. 20% of the people who live in Redmond work in Bend. So the state highway is really, really critical to us. There really is only one connection between Madras and Redmond, one connection between Madras and Prineville, a few more connections between Redmond and Bend, but really it's the state highway that we use. And we want to thank you for the OTIA bills, 1, 2, and 3. We're using those. They're real critical to us with the fast growth that we're having. I think Redmond has about $100 million worth of projects that we're doing there. And being the hub of Central Oregon, it really benefits all of the cities in Central Oregon because they most likely come through Redmond to get to other cities. What do we see as the future? I think the future is that we all need to work together. And that's what we're doing in COAC. We're talking together as a region on how does the state highway, the city system, and the county system help people travel around our communities and get to where they want to go. Like Scott has said, people don't care who owns these roads. They just want to get out of their garage, and they want to go to the store or to work or wherever. So as we work together, we can create that system that has a good local network so we don't impact the state highway quite as much, so that when we do need to go from one community to the other, we can get on the state highway, whether it's on the north, middle, or south end of a community, and go to those other communities. State law requires us to accommodate growth, so it's a real challenge for us. In Central Oregon, we're just growing like gangbusters. In the last 10 years, I think Redmond has had a growth of about 10%. So half the people who live there today did not live there 10 years ago. And we're trying to do our part. We're working hard at helping grow our systems, to increasing our urban growth boundary, to do that smart planning so that there are neighborhood centers. Instead of having to go to the grocery store downtown, you can go to the neighborhood centers. We're looking at industrial land on both sides of our community so that you can get to those call centers and those other new things that we're going to have without having to travel across town. Street conditions. We're working hard to keep our streets up. Chip seal works great in Central Oregon. You got to keep those cracks covered because once water seeps down into those roads with our freeze-thaw cycles, they just break up really quick. So we are working hard. I think transportation is one of the biggest centers of our budget. So we really work hard at that. The airport. The airport is really one of the successes we have here in Central Oregon. Having over 35 flights a day coming in and out brings those people, brings that growth here. Destination resorts would not be successful if they couldn't come from those areas to spend that month or 3 weeks or whatever they do at the houses that they have here. There's lots of 1031 money coming into Central Oregon. People are bailing out of the other areas they have. They're moving here. That's a lot of what's happening here. Paying for roads is very difficult. We have property taxes and franchise fees, and that's basically what we collect in order to help fund our road systems. Property taxes are limited. They're not going up as quickly as costs are. As new houses come in, they are placed at a lower rate than the houses that were here before. We'd like to talk more in the future about how we collect taxes from houses. You know, in California, you kept a low tax base for a person, but then when they sold their house, that house jumped up to a new tax base to reflect the price that a new person bought it at, and then it stayed at that level and moved up slowly. A system maybe that would help us collect more taxes, to do more improvements, to do those things for people who live in Oregon. The people live, your citizens, our citizens, they live in our communities, and we all look to you to be partners to help us with the hard choices and the costs that we need to do. We look with ODOT. ODOT are great partners with Bob Bryant, our regional manager, Gary Farnsworth, our area manager. We meet often. We work together. We collaborate to find solutions. And it's a very refreshing, good relationship that we have. I remember when I started working in city government and being a volunteer back in the 90s, I didn't know my regional manager. I only saw him maybe once a year and barely could talk to him. The relationship we have today helps us come up with solutions and helps all of Oregon. So thank you and good luck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And gentlemen, thank you for being here today. Judge Cooper, you had mentioned the Anchorage Railroad crossings. Can you give us an idea how many there are collectively in Central Oregon?
I can refer that question to Farnsworth.
I don't know the number off the top of my head, but there's somewhere in the range of 70 to 80.
70 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 11 Anchorage crossings in the city of Bend alone. And Mayor Unger in Redmond, you've probably got
almost a dozen.
Yeah.
I think we've got 13.
Yeah. This is a huge issue for us here in Central Oregon. And something that we're going to have to figure out. And, you know, we've got railroad here on the agenda later. And I hope we'll be able to discuss that a little bit more later. But I just kind of want to get that out there. A couple more questions,
sure.
Mr.
Absolutely.
Chair. Thank you. Judge Cooper and Mayor Unger, perhaps you could share with the committee how our public transit system here in Central Oregon is doing.
Do we have one, Judge?
No! Well, it's a mixed bag. As far as our general public transits, I don't think that you could say that there's a regional public transit system in place for the public at large. Let me break it down and talk about the public transit system that we run for the senior and disabled population, which is a special section of ODOT. I don't think there's a program in government that you get more bang for your buck on than that particular program, the ride brokerage, which is for the seniors and for the disabled folks to get both from Prineville to Redmond or Prineville to Bend and within Bend itself. For very limited dollars, almost all of us are running those through nonprofit organizations, which are making good use of them and charging nominal dollars and a lot of volunteer hours in order to keep them running. They are incredibly effective for the small amount of money that we put in. I think our total, I'm not going to use the number because I'll get it wrong in my head, but it's basically self-funded and funded through the ride fare program, not through the state subsidies. that we struggled a bit more with the issue of a regional transit system that will serve the general public or even transit systems within individual communities for one simple reason. You can build it, but will they come? We are very, very wedded in this region to the idea of staying in our cars and being able to drive exactly to where we want to go. And there's not huge excitement for the idea that I might actually have to get out a few blocks away and walk to my ultimate destination. And the number of links it would take in order to cover a region of over 10,000 square miles and get everybody exactly where they want to go is pretty astonishing. So the city of Bend has probably been more of a leader on that than anybody, and I know that they have struggled mightily to keep the thing in the black. Well, they haven't succeeded in keeping it in the black. The rest of us are still in the early planning stages trying to determine just how big it would be, how far it would go, and how many people would like to use it.
In about 1999, through Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council, a COG we have here, we got a grant to study public transit between communities, and we put together some studies that said, what if we took, like, dial-a-ride buses and went from Redmond to Bend and had a fixed route that went back and forth on a schedule? The study showed that it would cost us $50 a rider to get the system set up in place and $20 a rider for it to be in operation all the time. The county looked at that in a big meeting and said, well, when the grant's gone, who's going to pay for the subsidy to keep this thing operating? And I think we basically looked to the county and said, well, probably you, and they said, we don't have the funds, we can't afford to do that, and basically the idea just dropped right there. We do need to have public transportation. We need a plan that really works. They're all expensive. Somebody needs to think out of the box and comes up with something that works. If we could have a way to handle, like, insurance costs, maybe people who are older have cars and are able to be in a pool to where, like, Meals on Wheels is done. You can go pick people up and take them to the store. They could be your neighbor. They could be someone of similar age or something else. It could be a real socialization thing for people. But there should be some out-of-the-box ways that we can help people get to the doctor's office, get to the store, do those things, and help ourselves. In terms of people going to work in other communities, it happens a lot. Carpooling, van, we have commute options. It has some options that can work. The challenge is, how do we get those people together and a way to make that happen? We need public transit. You come up with some ideas, we'd sure like to partner.
Ellen's comments come up with a couple other thoughts. We are trying to figure out how to integrate the federal partnership into our transit planning now. What we got a message loud and clear during the visit to Washington a couple months ago that we should definitely be applying for more grants than we are currently applying for. So I believe that the Metropolitan Planning Organization is taking the lead in trying to figure out how we could bring some federal dollars to help close that gap. The other piece that I don't want to leave on tape, I don't want to leave unmentioned, is the price of gas is killing. It's killing all of our volunteer efforts, whether it's our interfaith caregivers giving seniors rides to and from outlying communities to the hospital, or our Meals on Wheels volunteers taking food out to the elderly. You might have noticed when you came through town today the price is consistently $3.15 a gallon. I love those little media reports about the average price of gas in Oregon is $2.90 and falling. We haven't seen $2.90 in a month. So that's going to be a challenge that's further going to complicate our efforts to keep any sort of shared ride arrangement going in the months ahead.
Any more questions, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Thank you. Gary, I hate to let you go here without talking a little bit more. In your handout on Attachment 1, the planned 2006-2009 STIP, page 1, about two-thirds of the way down, is the U.S. 97 at Cooley Road Interchange. This project, this quote-unquote North End project, has been on the books, been on SLIP now for a while. And there was some development last fall and early this year regarding that with the Oregon Transportation Commission. And I'd like for you to please tell the committee what exactly did the OTC do with this, and And my specific question is, I'm still trying to figure out what authority the OTC has to do this.
The project that you've identified shows a $20 million program amount, and $15 million comes from the OTIA 3 freight mobility program, out of the modernization portion of OTIA 3 program. The other $5 million is from City of Bend contribution. In fact, the agreement we have with the City of Bend actually shows their commitment for it, totaling $7.5 million. So that's a little bit about the funding source. This was adopted into the STIP last summer. I believe it was the August time frame that the Transportation Commission adopted it into the STIP. And they put a condition on the adoption for this project, and the condition was that we would complete a refinement plan, a facility-type plan that's going on the north end of Bend for US 97, US 20. That refinement plan is in progress. The expectation is that when that study is completed, this project, this funding would be identified for the first phase of implementing that refinement.
So, what, if I understand correctly, what OTC did was they basically took this project off the list, or at least moved it back from, I thought originally it was a 2007 project, to some indeterminate date now until this refinement plan is done.
Well, we had originally proposed it, ODOT, for 2007 construction start, and relatively aggressive under any circumstances. So that came from us locally. And as they reviewed that project, they looked at the things they had interest in for the long-range plan for the north end of Bend, and that's what drove them to the decision. They wanted to make sure that they were comfortable that it would fit into that long-range plan before they would gavel down on the design and right-of-way requirements to get the project. So that has had an effect on the interest we had from timeline to city originally. Since that time, ODOT, the city, the county, the MPO, we've been working closely together with the community to make sure we do get the right long-range plan in place. And that simply is going to take time.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Gary, I guess the thing that I'm struggling with here, and for the benefit of the committee members, when you drive into Bend on the north end of town now on Highway 97, which is, you'll see the new Lowe's there, and immediately, well, right in that same intersection, Walmart's looking at putting a super center in there. This is also was at one point considered to be the main access to 1,500 acres that the city of Bend owns that we're trying to develop for higher educational campus, for industrial, and to some extent residential. So it's a huge traffic load. And what concerns me is I'm trying to figure out who's on first and what's on second. You know, who makes the final call on this thing? We have, as Gary said, we've got the MPO involved, the county's involved, the Bend Chamber's been very involved because this is going to have a huge impact on business. We've got two or three very substantial subdivisions up in that area that could be significantly impacted. And I guess, Gary, what I'm trying to figure out is this, is the ultimate decision on this up to the OTC on the final alignment of all this?
Which decision are you talking about?
The final alignment here at the north end, 97 and the parkway and all that, and Highway 20.
If we're talking specifically about refinement plan, which is fits the bill for what we're trying to accomplish in terms of long range, we have an expectation that the MPO will adopt the long-range plan, the city will adopt the long-range plan, and the Transportation Commission will also adopt the plan. So it will take essentially all three entities, in this case with the MPO, including part of Deschutes County. The expectation is that Deschutes County will have to adopt the plan, the city will have to adopt the plan, and the Transportation Commission will have to adopt the plan for us to get to a point of unity so we can move forward with implementing the construction. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that my question is pretty well answered. It was regarding the was there a public transportation regional district? And I think you pretty well know that. There is none, and you've done a lot of thinking about it.
Thank you. spent a fair amount of time talking to the former ODOT director about those instances where a state highway is really the main street of the town. It happens in my district and the community called Linton, and it's happened, I think, in several other of our districts. It's clearly true in Redmond that 97 is sort of your main street. It looks like 26 is the main street again. Do you have a sense that there's some special obligation of ODOT to move beyond state highway, moving freight through, moving cars through, when a state highway is the main street of a town? Have you been able to work out some sense of special relationship?
Well, it sounds like Scott's got something to say about that, but let me start. I think it's a partnership, and yes, I think that it's something that, you know, as a community grows, we started off with the Main Street being the community. And then as we get bigger and bigger and as traffic gets more, we get choked with that traffic that goes through your community, and your heart starts to die. At that point, we need to look for other solutions. It's difficult. It's difficult with the way the laws are written to where you need to look for solutions within your urban growth boundary. You can't go outside of it. That protects farm and forest lands in the valley, but out here where we have scrub brush, that looks like the best place to go, but we're not able to go there. So I think it's a collective thing, and I appreciate the question, and I hope that ODOT continues to look actively on how to move the highway out from around the center of the community. It takes a while for the community to agree to that because the business owners say they need that pass-by traffic until it gets to a certain point to where it's killing them, and then they want it out right away. But it's a tough question. It's tough to have answers. We would like to see the state highway, as time goes into the future, be that through movement that's just outside of your community so that you can have a walkable, vibrant community that's grown up. Scott.
Let me be completely politically incorrect on this one. So that question just chaps my behind. This is why. When we talk about the federal system and the interstates connecting both sides of Portland or connecting Wilsonville and Salem, the state is very rapid to say that those are primary arterials and the state needs to pay for it and we need to allow for local access and we need to recognize just how important they are and they serve all the citizens of the United States, including the citizens of Oregon, but the federal government ought to pay for it. When we bring that same discussion down to the local level, then the answer that comes back is, well, these are state highways, and therefore the movement of freight through communities, and communities, if they want to improve us to them, should pay for them. Now, look, the standard should be the consistent on both ends. Yeah. So, in my view, the state, especially the OTC in particular, and one member thereof, suffers from a great deal of attraction to double standards and hypocrisy.
I was wondering if you could tell us how he really feels about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would hope for an equally activist response. Both Judge Cooper and Mayor Unger very articulately outlined needs, expanded capacity, existing capacity, freight, passenger vehicle. Talk about what you see as a way, as the best way, or maybe it's more than one way, to actually get the funding to implement those projects. You as too many of us on this panel, represent communities that are not particularly tax loving. But talk about what you see as the places that you and your constituents you think would buy as additional sources of revenue to make these investments to address these needs.
From my perspective, there's two answers to that. Revenue comes in two forms. It comes in the form of more money into the system, and it comes in the form of less expenses going into individual projects. I'd start with the first one. I've testified in front of this panel before regarding the cost of doing a project in Oregon and how ridiculously expensive it is for us to build roads. We now calculate it's a 40% premium in order to do a prevailing wage project in this state. there is a 30% holdback on contingency for any of our road projects that we're building. If we could just deal with those two issues alone, how much more bang for the buck could we get out of the existing budget? And then there is the incredible way that we do the environmental consultation in this state, and we go around and we look at, with the different agencies, what their wish list is that they'd like to add on to the cost of a highway project. So, for example, when this county was looking at building the Milliken Road connection from Prineville through to Highway 20, one of the things they were asking us to do, we ended up doing ourselves because the state was too expensive to do it, but we were asked to do a two-year, $500,000 study of all of the fisheries of Southeast Oregon because there might be more people fishing in them, and that would impact the fish, so we needed to throw that into the bill. We needed to build a 12-mile-high experimental elk fence, a 12-foot-high experimental elk fence on both sides of the road, install 12 different undercrossings for deer to cross safely under the road instead of cut the trees back. Tag antelope for 6 months and count how many times they cross the road. Count the seasonal tadpoles in the ponds along the roadway. And then the project ended up being a $28 million project, and we built it for four. Now, there is some common sense that can be applied to how we engineer these projects that could put more revenue back in the system and more paving on the ground. The second side, and it's not popular, and nobody wants to talk about it in the present environment, but how long has it been since we've addressed the gas tax? We've got to have the conversation about the gas tax. It's been 14 years since we raised the gas tax in the state. Washington did it. We all saw the political pain that it caused. But inflation does eat in there, and we've got to figure out some way to make the highways continue to pay for themselves. I think a third one that we haven't really looked at is the differentiation in the transportation SDCs that are being assessed statewide. We've got jurisdictions that are charging $10,000 per unit for a transportation SDC and jurisdictions which are charging nothing for a transportation SDC. That probably doesn't make sense as a statewide policy. I know John Chandler from the Home Builders has a proposal that he's floating around in legislative concept to do a single statewide SDC that would cover everything and leave it to the local jurisdictions to divide it up between the different eligible entities, sewer, water, parks, fire, stormwater, roads, whatever. I'm not sure that doesn't look like a potentially better solution so that everybody is doing the same thing and everybody can build that cost into their pro forma and not be at the mercy of whatever creative consultant we hire this month to figure out how to extract more money from the public.
I agree with Scott. The first thing is to reduce some of the rules. Redmond's reroute started in 1998. By the time it's finished, it will have taken 10 years for it to go from start a plan to build out. In that time, real estate prices go up 2 to 5, 10% a year. I think 30 to 40% of the cost of the project is acquiring real estate to build the project on. And some of the rules state that we can't, as a city, go proactively buy right-of-way and hold it so that when ODOT's ready to do a project, that we can then sell it to them, and then the project moves forward. They've got a system where they've got to go work with the right-of-way people, go, and before you know it, they're asking prices that are just hot. They're high prices, and they create high costs. In terms of how do we pay for roads, we're asked as local jurisdictions to pay 20-25% of the cost of a project. I see some fairness in that, but if it takes away from our ability to create our own local street system, then we create this new better road system that everybody flocks to, and you lose capacity on it. So there needs to be a balance between what you ask cities to pay for systems and what you expect them to do with their local system improvements. Back in about 1998 or so, Central Oregon, I think I was part of a meeting that we would go to Bend. Bend and Redmond were looking at how can we find other funding for road maintenance and other projects. And we looked at different types of funding, local gas taxes, a sales tax, just different types of things. The only one that came up with enough money that really made a difference was a real estate transfer tax, a real estate transfer fee. You know, it doesn't have to be a lot. That's where there's an opportunity for people to make a willful choice. You're not putting it on everybody. And I'm sure that there's a lot of interest in something like that, but transportation affects everything.
Thank you. Aaron Whistler, got a question?
Thank you, Chair Gilman. Actually, I was going to ask Judge Cooper how prevailing wage and environmental consultation had, what effect that had on the cost of rural roads. But I won't ask again because he will suck all the oxygen out of the room. I think there's a couple of other things that need to be added to that, Scott. I mean, archaeological evaluations, wetland preservation rules and regulations. I think there's 51 laws now between state and federal laws that address wetlands. We have created a morass of costly regulations and added labor costs that make us unaffordable. And I think, with due respect, rather than raising taxes and fees, we need to address the cutting the costs that we have created ourselves.
I'll give you a good example of that, Senator, on the archaeological look, and that was a local bridge that we were replacing in the upper country in Cook County. And that, of course, was an OTIA project, so that was regulated by the state. We had an unhappy someone up there who didn't want that particular bridge to be replaced, would have preferred that we abandoned it. And so went in one night and sowed arrowheads on the ground, right there on the top of the soil. They just magically appeared. Obviously, they're not in the right place at the right time. They weren't there the day before, but nothing doing. But we had to call in a consultant from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington to come in and look at them and determine where they came from and how old they were. And, yep, they really didn't belong there. We missed the entire in-water season for constructing that bridge. It pushed back the construction for a year so that we could determine that something that hadn't been there one day and was there the next day really wasn't supposed to have been there. And there is some room, as I said, for common sense in this process.
Any further questions for the panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize you're running out of time here, but just got maybe more of a comment than a question. The 6 years ago, I remember very clearly participating in an effort to get an additional gas tax passed. And needless to say, I was really on the losing side of that issue. It went down 88-12. And so I'm not sure that the state of Oregon, even with the given price of gasoline now, is ready for a gas tax increase, even though we see our gas prices jump by 5, 10, 15 cents a gallon per each day. You know, but even with you mentioned 2 cent increase in the gas tax, I think you would bring the wrath of God down upon you. And then in the last session, we spent a great deal of time looking at prevailing wage in my business committee and passed some of the first legislation dealing with prevailing wage in a long time. And even though it may, in some instances, drive up the cost of construction jobs, there's a lot of benefits associated with that, particularly when you got a great deal of construction projects going on now and finding labor to do those jobs. We actually are experiencing somewhat of a shortage in good construction workers in the state of Oregon now. And if we don't train that workforce and have the ability there to hire and train that workforce, we're not going to serve our labor community and our communities real well. Thank you.
I certainly concur with your points, Representative, and I recognize the political difficulty of dealing with the gas tax issue. I might point out, though, my county colleagues won't forgive me if I don't, that if the county payments bill is not reauthorized and all of that money is removed from the system, that will need the gas tax and then some in order to make up that deficiency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give a little more history on the last gas tax, if people don't remember. It was saddled with the weight mile piece that would have gotten rid of the weight mile. At that point in time, AAA said there's no way, and they put this gas tax on the ballot. Otherwise, it would not have even gone to the ballot to be voted on. So I think that's one of the things we have to keep in mind.
further questions or comments?
I'm just curious, is that something you should review at the meeting?
I'm anticipating in Salem on the September 5th meeting, we'll talk about in hand.
Yep. If I may, then, just if that's going to be on the subject for a future meeting, I'd like to ask that perhaps we have some information. One of the things I'm not clear on yet is how exactly is the gas tax revenue today appropriated? And this is kind of tied up with my questions about OTC. I'm still trying to sort out what authority the legislature has and what authority the Oregon Transportation Commission has, which, as we all know, is not an elected body. They're only accountable to the person that appoints them, which is the governor. I'm still trying to figure out who really has authority for what. So I'd be curious at some point in the future to learn more about all of that.
Hey. Thank you, panel. Very informative. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Doug Kendall.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation. Great place to be here in Prineville, although my time schedule didn't allow me to come over early enough to play golf with Major Mayor Wendell. Unfortunately, I'll work on that for next time. First topic that I'll talk to you about today is on state and federal sign laws and the impact of a recent Supreme Court decision. Let me just start by saying what we're talking about here is signs that are off of state highway right-of-way, but visible from a state highway. And then I have to put in another exception that this is does not apply to certain signs such as political signs. So there's one class of signs that I'm going to be talking about today called outdoor advertising signs. Regulation of outdoor advertising signs goes back to 1965. It went at the federal level. Beautification Act was passed, limiting the number of, or attempting to limit the number of signs that were visible from certain federal highways. A state law in Oregon followed in the mid-1970s that followed the federal law fairly closely with a couple of distinctions. And I'm going to name four of them. That were fairly important. The state law applied to all state highways, whereas the federal law applied to certain federal highways. Now, this is not a huge distinction because most state highways are of the classifications that the federal law applied to anyway. But there are some state highways that would have not been covered under the federal law. The state law then covered all of the state highways. The way the state law was constructed, it effectively capped the number of permits that could be issued for outdoor advertising signs or billboards. And it also grandfathered in, effectively granting a permit to any sign that existed in 1975. The last difference that is, and what's the most important difference relative to the Supreme Court case, is that it drew a distinction, the state law draws a distinction between what are called on-premise signs and off-premise signs. On-premise signs, it would be an outdoor advertising sign that is on the same property as the business for which it's signing. So Arctic Circle or Chevron, as you drive through town, those are all on-premise signs. Off-premise signs, then, are outdoor advertising signs that are not on the same piece of property. And this distinction is important. Our practice was, since on-premise signs were allowed, we didn't issue permits for those on-premise signs. We did issue permits for off-premise signs, and then they're subject to the cap that was put in place by the state law. What the Supreme Court decision did is eliminate the distinction between on-premise and off-premise signs. They said that you can't, because of freedom of speech, a state constitution, freedom of speech, you can't distinguish between on-premise and off-premise signs. They Then the court went on to say there's two possibilities here that you could, as a remedy for this, for the state to deal with this. One, you could require permits for all signs, on-premise and off-premise. Or two, you could require no permits for any signs. The court, with some concern from us, from the ODOT standpoint, without having any briefing or discussion about which one of those two remedies, or to just suggest that there are two remedies, the court picked one, and the court picked a remedy that takes away our ability to permit any sign, be that on-premise or off-premise. We filed a petition for reconsideration on the remedy portion because it was created without any briefing or legal argument. We would have preferred to work with the legislature and say, you know, what's the appropriate solution here. We're not going to quibble with the Supreme Court over the constitutional freedom of expression issue, but we would like to talk to them about, or we would think it would be appropriate to talk to the legislature about the, how we want to go about, or if we want to go about, regulating outdoor advertising signs. While that petition for reconsideration of remedies in place, the law remains as it is. The ruling will not be filed. The Supreme Court will look at that petition and decide whether or not they want to hear it. If they don't hear it, then their judgment will be entered and will take effect. If they do decide to hear that petition for reconsideration, the court will deliberate and on the remedy portion and decide at some point in the future. What we're concerned about from a department standpoint is a potential loss of federal funds. When the federal bill went in 1965, it carried with it a penalty of 10% of the federal funds in certain federal fund categories. It amounts to $25 to $30 million a year for Oregon that the feds could withhold if we did not adequately regulate outdoor advertising signs. And so that's our concern. Also, it is possible that you could wind up with a greatly expanded number of billboards along the highways. What we're doing about it is we're working with the our Department of Justice, the Federal Highway Administration, and the stakeholders, some of the billboard companies, to try and come up with some options that could be considered by the 2007 legislature if the Supreme Court ruling was not implemented prior to that. So, appreciate the opportunity to be here. Glad to answer any questions along a rather confusing set of laws.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Hunt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing, Doug, that this would be helpful for me, not so much today, but maybe if you can get us some kind of a briefing that outlines, I have no clue what the costs are for these permits, if that's a, ends up being a self-funded thing for ODOT, if there's some net cost of administering the permit process. And then if we were to go for the option of requiring permits for both on-premise and off-premise signs, what the kind of the fiscal impact in terms of ODOT would be, the cost of permit, that whole realm of stuff I think would be helpful, not today, but in terms of the background information, at least for me.
Okay. Chair Gilman, Representative Hutt, I can tell you that in the opinion, the DOJ opinion, 2001 DOJ opinion on the constitutional uses of state gas taxes, regulation of off right-of-way billboards is not a constitutional regulation for a constitutional use of the state highway fund. So that permit program does pay for itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, if the court order stands and we can no longer regulate outdoor advertising, how much of a bind does that put us in with federal funds?
Well, Chair Gilman, Representative Brown, we're working with the Federal Highway Administration to try and minimize that and to try and suggest that they not immediately start taking money away from us, that we at least go through the 2007 legislative session to find out if the legislature is interested in any sort of agreement that would mitigate the Supreme Court decision in a way that would be acceptable for the federal government. They are not, the FHWA is not pounding on our door saying, you better fix this or we're taking your money now. I don't think that's going to happen right away. They've been a good partner and working with us and trying to come up with some ideas that can take care of an action that we can take that will meet the federal requirements and not require that. But in the long term, if it were to go in just as it is now with no regulation, the potential exists that the FHWA could come back in the future and take that 10% of our money.
10%?
Yeah, 10%. I'm sorry, Representative Brown, it's between $25 and $30 million a year would be the potential impact.
Other questions? I have one. How were other states? They must have gone different routes before. And they're not in trouble with the Supreme Court, I'm assuming.
Chair Gilman, this was the Oregon Supreme Court, not the U.S.
Oh, over.
Okay, so this was a ruling in Oregon. Different states have different ways of meeting the federal requirement. There is one in the South, and I can't remember if it's Georgia or Louisiana, I believe it's one of those two states, the FHWA is having some discussion with them about whether or not they have appropriate controls over outdoor advertising. But I believe to date, FHWA has not taken action to withhold funds from any state.
Thank you.
You might have said this earlier, and forgive me for asking this again if you did, but we're talking about signs that are strictly on federal highways or federal and state highways, or does this include local ones?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, the federal law and state law, the state law pertains to signs visible from state off of right-of-way, visible from a state highway. The federal law pertains to signs off of highway right-of-way, visible to certain federal highways. Whether or not, I don't believe that there's any local highway that's of the federal classification that this would enter into. So what we're talking here is state highways.
I think it'd be helpful to follow up on Representative Hunt's question with some briefing, some more detailed briefing information. If one of the options is to require permits for on and off premise, I think it'd be helpful to have some quantification of how many on-premise signs this might affect. If every one of these signs going down Main Street and find a plan to have a permit, that's pretty extensive. But if we're talking about a smaller subset, it'd be helpful that you have to get a handle on that.
Good. In most cities now, the cities regulate the outdoor advertising within their city limits, and it's just only outside of the city limits that Department of Transportation is involved.
Chair Gilman, Representative Brown, I believe that state law applies to all state highways, whether they're inside or outside the city, but I'm not sure about that. I'll check on it.
Then how come I had to go to the city of Newport to get a permit to put my sign up?
Well, Chair Gilman, Representative Brown, I am aware that many cities have ordinances on any sign, whether it's on, regardless of where it is, and if it's on your building, if it's on your property. There are cities that have, I know cities have ordinances around signing that are probably more restrictive than what we're talking about from the state.
A lot more expensive.
Well, one option, I guess, would be to equalize those and raise the state permits to that city. If that's a concern for you.
Any further discussion?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the courtesy. My name is Dave Barrows. I represent Clear Channel Outdoor Advertising. Clear Channel is the largest outdoor billboard company in the state, but there are other large ones also. And I just want to assure the committee that we have had meetings with the department. Our lawyers have met with their lawyers. We are very supportive of trying to get this issue resolved. Having the law go away is not in anybody's best interest, in our opinion, except for perhaps the people who caused this problem. But for the large regulated companies that do most of the outdoor billboards in this state. We are strongly supportive. We're filing an amicus brief on their petition for rehearing to try and get to a resolution of this that frankly doesn't require the creating of a large... I don't know that anybody's talking about creating a large bureaucracy where you have this ODOT going up and down the street doing on-premise. I mean, that's just a horror that I think both of us would agree is not the desirable way to go. So I appreciate the chance to pass that information on to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, this may be a stupid question of the day, but who is Outdoor Media Dimensions, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit? And why did they bring this court? What did they hope to gain out of this? What was the issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, I am not an authority on this case, and frankly, the part that we're here talking about today wasn't even discussed in front of the court. It was never briefed. That's one of the concerns that we all have, is that they were briefed, never discussed, never argued. And the court just said, oh, and by the way, you got a problem with the free speech provision of the Oregon Constitution, which we've all seen pretty a number of recent cases involving that. There is an individual who has put up signs in the state without permits, and that has caused unhappiness on behalf of those companies that pay for the system, and we do, and we acceded to increase permit fees within the last couple of years in order that the licensing division for outdoor billboards would be fully self-supporting and there would be no gas money because they can't use it. This individual is putting up signs, put one up in Medford in which the message was the Pope is the Antichrist. That caused some concern by some citizens in that community and then has put additional signs up along the coast. And we have been, frankly, critical of the department for not being more aggressive about going after this individual. I can't give you the legal pieces of the case, because, frankly, I didn't follow it that closely because I didn't think it really had great implications for my client and the other major outdoor billboard companies. But this particular piece of the decision is very problematic and has to be address.
Thank you very much. We're going to take 5 minutes now, just five. That's all you get. But we need to connect with the phone to the next set of testifiers. So give me 5 minutes, and we'll be back.
What?
and introduce yourself.
First of all, my food record, my name is Sandra Hilton, and I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State's audit position.
Okay.
I'm also, too, here. I'll turn it over to Chuck Hittner, who's our director. He's here as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman and committee members. Chuck Hittner, director of the audit division. And if I might just make a couple quick remarks before Sandy gets into the, I think it's the nuts and bolts of the audit report. I just kind of wanted to note for you that as you get a chance to read through the report, you'll notice that there's a couple things in there that are fairly prescriptive regarding things we think the agency may be able to do to improve procedures to get to that best price, that fair market best price. The other thing that we did add in this report was a kind of an informational component that talks about some of the profit and profit components and cost components. The other thing that I want to take just as a second to mention was to express our thanks to the agency and even to several members of the industry who helped us with this audit, especially early on when we were trying to determine what was important about this particular topic. And even when it came down to our methodology for costing out some of these services, they were very helpful. We talked to them about what we had planned to do. They gave us great feedback, and we went on forward and did the audit, and I think put together a pretty good report that should be helpful to decision makers within the agency and also to the other decision makers like yourself. And if you have any specific questions at the time, that would be great. If not, then why don't I turn it over to Sandy, and she can get into the kind of the details of the report.
I don't think we have any questions here, so Sandra, you can go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chair Gilman, members of the committee, first of all, I would like to thank you all for your interest in this audit. I am very happy to have this opportunity to provide the committee with some of the key results that we did identify in our work. What I'd like to do is just kind of summarize for you some of the key areas. First of all, I'd like to start with the purpose of our audit, which was to determine if the department's methods of obtaining design engineering services for projects have resulted in the lowest possible cost to the state. And what we determined was that the department's contracting practices did not ensure the lowest possible cost to the state for design engineering services. When we compared consultant paid invoices to estimated in-house costs for 12 design engineering work order contracts, we concluded consultant costs were approximately 20% higher. When we break that down by project, we found that really there was quite a range as far as the cost differences go. We had from a low of approximately 5% to a high of 30%. And on page 4 of our audit report, you can see where we had put that out in the graph as well. Right below that graph is another graph that gives a breakdown of the cost difference. And as you can see by looking at that graph, that profit comprises the single highest cost component of approximately 43%, with the remaining 57% in the department's contract monitoring costs and higher contractor salaries and overhead costs. In addition to our cost comparisons here, we also went in and reviewed the department's contracting processes, and we determined that the department can more aggressively negotiate their design engineering contracts. We also found the department did not have the information necessary to establish some strong positions to negotiate from. And we really felt that this was really important, especially in the current environment of the large-scale outsourcing that is needed in order to respond to the recent Lucia legislation. What we found when we looked at these work order contracts is that the prime contractor for 10 of the 12 contracts included in our comparison received what appeared to be a standard and not negotiated 10.5% profit figure. We also reviewed files for the work order contracts granted under 5 different agreements to agree contracts. And we also found that the not-to-exceed dollar amount on the contract matched the contractor's estimates, which were provided in the summary estimate of services that the consultant furnished to us, or to the department, I'm sorry. This indicated to us that the department did not aggressively negotiate price. In addition, we didn't find find any other evidence in the contract files that suggested that the negotiation had occurred. In addition to the negotiation of price, we also found that there was little evidence that the department evaluated or negotiated consultant direct labor rates, or evidence that the department either accepted an audited overhead rate or evaluated and negotiated an overhead rate with the consultant. What we found when we talked to department staff is that we were told that they were behind in performing the evaluation for the consultant overhead rate. And one of the department documents that we reviewed had a footnote on it stating that only 3 of the 17 audits of consultant overhead rates identified as needing to be done had in fact been completed. What we understand is that federal regulations do require the department to initially select consultants based on quality. However, the same regulations also require negotiation of price to ensure a fair and reasonable price is obtained. Similarly, state laws require the compensation paid to consultants be reasonable and fair. We found that a valuable tool that could assist the department in negotiating these contracts is the use of cost estimates, which this can give the department a position to negotiate from. In fact, in our research, we found that federal regulations actually require the preparation and use of cost estimates in the negotiation of contracts for contract modifications expected to exceed $100,000. We also identified some best practices for contracting which stress the importance of cost information when comparing in-house and contracted services. Our feeling was that cost estimates would not only assist the department in negotiating the best price, but they could also be very useful information for the department to help them to make the decision of which projects to outsource and which to keep in-house. Further, when we performed our file review of work order contracts relating to 5 agreement-to-agree contracts, we did not find any evidence that any in-house cost estimates and full cost information related to contracting were prepared or used to negotiate contract prices. In June and September of 2004, we shared these initial findings and recommendations with department officials. Then, back in September and October of 2005, we performed some additional work to assess the department's progress toward addressing the issues we had shared with them. During our follow-up, we found that department management was aware of needed improvements, and we also found that they have developed some procedures for making those improvements. However, what we found in our follow-up, too, was that they really haven't had the actual implementation of the procedures. It was limited. Well, the area where the department improved the most was in the evaluation of consultant overhead rates. When we had performed our initial work, we had found that the unit responsible for consultant overhead rate reviews was really understaffed. During our initial work, the staff evaluating overhead rates had gone from 2 to 1. And actually, after we finished completing our initial field work, the last individual was assigned other duties, leaving no one available to review overhead rates. When we went back and did our follow-up work, we found that the staff had been increased to 3. And where that was an improvement, we had found, though, that best practices that we had identified suggest that it still may not have the resources it needs. Additionally, department staff explained to us that the department does not have a process in place to ensure consistent and current consultant overhead rates are maintained for department-wide use. Further, during our follow-up, we also reviewed contract files for 4 agreements to agree and 7 work order contracts. What we found is that there was little evidence that negotiations with the consultants was occurring. We did find that there was more evidence to suggest the negotiation may have occurred, but the underlying documentation to support a negotiation was not available. In other words, in a couple of instances, we found, you know, maybe a copy of an email that showed it looked like that there possibly had been a negotiation, but we didn't have the details of the transaction there, the negotiation process that wasn't recorded. Department staff also told us contract files were not periodically reviewed to assess the completeness and accuracy of the negotiation process. Also, during our follow-up work, we were asking about cost estimates. and we were told that one contract administrator was now preparing in-house cost estimates using the department's historical data. However, when we spoke to the contract administrator, we were told that he has prepared only two cost estimates for individual work order contracts, and this is as of October 2005. Lastly, in our audit report, we also expressed some concern over the loss of the in-house engineering expertise needed to monitor the consultants and to make informed decisions regarding the quality and price of consultant services. We found that experienced department engineers are actively recruited by and looking for private sector design engineering firms. For instance, five of the department's seven business managers left to work for consultants between September 2003 and January 2004. Also, four of the original 12 contract administrators for the work order contracts in our cost comparisons left the department to work for consultants. Department officials expressed concern and awareness of the potential consequences of lost expertise, and they shared with us the actions that they plan to take in response. These actions included such things as salary increases and a new engineering classification system, among other things. To summarize our recommendations, we have recommended the department implement processes to ensure the evaluation of consultant overhead and direct labor and negotiation of contract price. Additional recommendations included designating staff to review and analyze consultant labor and overhead rates and to prepare cost estimates. As you can see in our report, we have provided more detailed recommendations in the report. Before ending my presentation, though, I would also like to add a brief comment about our methodology. In general, we use the full cost of services in a cost comparison. For example, we identified costs such as contract monitoring and captured them as part of our testing process. We also include things like overhead and direct and indirect labor for the department as well. However, there were some costs that we were not able to include in our comparison. For example, we did not have a suitable method for capturing the department's cost for creating and negotiating each individual contract. We also did not have the information to capture costs incurred by the consultants for variance in workload levels or any of the business taxes consultants paid, which could potentially offset the cost of outsourcing. And we were not able to evaluate any innovative and other qualitative differences, if any, between the contractors and department members. In addition to performing the comparisons, we did a lot of reviewing of the contract-related documents and research pertinent federal and state laws and rules and policies and procedures of the department. And as Chuck had talked about, too, we did a lot of interviewing. We met with representatives of the design engineering firms. In addition to talking to them, we also interviewed many members of the department of staff and also members of the Federal Highway Administration. So that concludes my presentation. And once again, I'd like to thank you for your interest in this audit, and would be very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sandra. Representative Brown has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sandy, in your methodology and your computing this 20% higher cost of utilizing private sector engineers, did you take into consideration that whenever you hire an engineering firm, when they complete the job, they're gone? If you have in-house personnel, and you have an ongoing cost with those people between one job and another, did you was that factored into this 20% difference?
Chair Gilman, Representative Brown, that's a good question. That's one of those other factors that we're unable to actually have a methodology of how would you apply that to the cost of a particular work order contract.
And so
it is a cost, but it's one of those other factors that, how would you calculate that cost and put it in with a work order contract?
And question number two is, in the early departure of engineers from the department, do you suppose that the PERS, appropriate and very good PERS retirement and the opportunity for these people to have the best of both worlds might play a role in that early leaving the department?
Well, Chair Gilman, Representative Brown. There's probably a lot of factors that factored into that, but I wouldn't have the information to be able to tell you the reasons why, you know, people left. What was important to note for us was that there was a fairly significant loss in some of the expertise and in some of these areas where, you know, the gearing up for the OTA workload was occurring. The exact reasons for those, I wouldn't be able to tell you that. It's a good question.
Thank you.
Further question. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sandy, to follow up on Representative Brown's question about the 20% difference in cost, can you be more specific on the department cost that you were considering when you were comparing those to the contract cost? In other words, the contract cost is probably, you know, either an hourly rate or a daily rate or a monthly rate or maybe just a flat per job rate. But for the department cost, were you considering salaries alone or did you factor in all of the benefits that go along with the state employee compensation package?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, that's an excellent question. We did consider, we tried to make this as complete of a cost comparison as we usually can do. We did include, on the department side, we did include overhead, the department's overhead rate. We also included indirect labor as well as direct labor salary costs. So we were capturing information that would have went into sick leave, vacation leave, retirement, that information. So we loaded it up with that as well to make this a fair comparison. We also did the very best we could to identify any costs to monitor the contract. That was a little bit of a challenge to do because of the way the information system captures the costs that are billed to the project. But we were able to identify quite a bit of that. If anything, it, you know, it's probably not perfect, but it's as close as we can get. So, yes, we did absolutely consider that. That has been, we've noticed in our review that there had been some criticism of other cost comparisons that have been done because they haven't included that. We made every attempt to do that.
Thank you. Representative Hunt.
Chair. Sandy, I don't see any recommendations, any specific recommendation of what a reasonable profit percentage should be. You reference what it typically has been. I don't see in here where you reference what it should be or what a reasonable differential between what the agency might do in-house and what a private firm could do. You say 20% is not reasonable. Do you have a specific recommendation of what would be reasonable, both on the percentage over as well as on the profit percentage?
Chair Gilman, Representative Prince, I don't have a sense whether 20% is reasonable or not. I can say that in thinking back, and I'm doing some of this from memory here, it's been back a ways, but thinking back at some of the other cost comparisons that we looked at, there were differences that ranged probably in about the same amount between contracted and in-house costs. However, whether that was because of profit or exactly what that was, I don't know. I want the profit percentage. I don't have that information. What we tried to do here is, you know, we looked at the processes and we said, you know, is there a way that they could tighten these processes and negotiate, you know, the best price available. So, and we found that in these would be areas where they could negotiate and get information so that they could negotiate the best price. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Grinman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to make sense out of what you said here, and you said the biggest difference in that 20% had to do with excess profits, I think, was sort of the nature of that. May I infer from that the average salaries and fringe benefit rates between the state and the private firms for engineering talent were about the same, and that about the same number of hours for contract, same productivity between the two groups of employees was about equivalent?
Chair Gilman, Representative Greenwood, maybe if I explain something a little bit more, it might help on the cost comparison. what we did is, from the consultant side, we looked at the consultant invoices. And on the consultant invoices, what we actually had, we had the hours that were worked and the classification of the individual along with the labor that was charged for that. So what we did is we made an assumption here that the hours were the same. So we were able to take that and look for the equivalent position over at the Department of Transportation and figure for that number of hours, you know, how much it would cost for that employee. I would like to clarify something for the record, though, too. We're not stating that there's excess profit. What we're trying to say here is that of the cost difference, 43% of it was related to contractor profit. So I didn't want the committee to think that we are in any way stating that we felt that this was excess.
Yeah, both of those points, I don't understand. If you said that I see. The issue was just that there was profit over the cost, that the costs were basically the same for the same engineering work. But to add to that, and even including indirect costs, to add to that, what you had to pay was about 10% profit. I was taking 43% of the 20%. So that the main difference between the state contract and contracting outside was not that there was more or less productivity in the employees in either place, but that there was profit in the private contractor and no profit in the state. Is that?
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, I'd like to refer you to that, the figure number 2, the bottom of page 4. Maybe that'll clarify that a little bit more. I'm sorry for this being so confusing. It is, I know, with all the overhead and everything, that it's kind of hard to explain. But as you can see from that, you know, what you're saying is true. I mean, the largest chunk of the difference that we identified was this profit is at 43%. But there's still other costs in there as well. The overhead was higher, the salary, part of the difference was related to salary, and a chunk of it was related to the cost associated with monitoring the contract.
May I follow up again?
Yeah.
Is that to say that then the salaries on the private, the salaries and fringe benefits on, in the private market were higher than the salaries and fringe benefits in the state? Is that where the, is that where that 7% comes from?
Chair Gilman, members of the community, yes, that's correct. What we're saying here is that overall, when you look at all the cost comparisons, contractor salary was 7%, approximately 7% higher for the consultant than it was for in-house.
Yeah, Chair Gilman, Representative Greenlick, if I might, if you notice the four components there, you've got two components that are similar that are going to be true whether it's in-house or out-of-house, the contractor overhead rate and the contractor salary, which you can see that the contractors were 60% higher for overhead and 7% higher for salaries. And those two components that are unique to a contracting environment, which would be the profit and the monitoring, and that's what represented the difference.
Well, may I follow up on that? Yeah, it's not 43%, it's not 34% higher, as I understand that graph, and I think I understand graphs. That's of the 100% difference in the cost. That these are percentages of the 20%, right? These are differences, so it's 34% of the 20% is accounted for by department contract monitoring, not accounted for. I mean, it's not that it was 34% higher, is that? Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Gilman, Representative Greenlight, yes, that is correct, and I'm sorry to need that clarified. What this is this 100% is what of the 20%. So the 20% difference, this is how that difference is made up, what makes up that 20%.
Yeah, can I follow up again?
But
this will be the last one. But contract monitoring isn't something that would account for the fact that it costs less in the state. Contract monitoring is something that you have to add when you do an outside contract, right? So this would be this would be in a this would be a minus to the difference rather than a plus to the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I understand it's all part of the positive, but are you saying that contract monitoring costs more when there were internal contracts than when there were external contracts? If you need to do contract monitoring, that doesn't account for a lower cost with an internal contract, does it?
Yes.
It does. It's 20%.
20% higher.
I think
okay, I think I'm in the right direction.
In the contracting environment, of course, you need to add the contracting cost to that scenario if you're comparing it to something that was done in-house. And that was what we were attempting to do.
I had to get there on this. I don't have any more questions.
What's the name for it again?
I got a little confused there for a moment. When you're talking about the 7% of a 20% as being a salary difference, that 7% doesn't mean it's 7% higher. It just means it was higher, but it was that 7%.
No.
We don't have the exact percentage that the salaries on average were higher for contractors than for in-house.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank my colleague, Representative Greenlicht, for asking these questions because I, too, was completely befuddled by Figure 2. But I think I understand it now. What you're saying, for example, for the department contract monitoring, that's a cost that we would not be doing if we were not contracting that service out.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, the question I have, though, is if you go to Figure 1, where we have an average of 20% less expensive, I'm presuming that Figure 1 is based on total cost.
Is based on the total cost that we could identify and include in our analysis. But again, you know, there were some things that we couldn't on both sides. You know, there's some consultant items as well as some on the side of the Department of Transportation, for example. You know, the cost of preparing the contract, negotiating the contract, all those costs are not captured here because you need a methodology of how you could assign that to a particular work order contract, and we didn't have a suitable methodology to do that.
I'm not sure I quite followed that, but let me ask you a question because this might get at what you were just saying a different way. But what I'm trying to figure out in my mind is how we go from Figure 1, which is total cost, to Figure 2, which breaks out 1, 2, 3, 4 different cost components. Now, I would presume that in your methodology there was more than 4 cost components. And I'm just having a hard time really understanding the value of the information that's in Figure 2.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, the reason we put Figure 2 in there, we thought that it would be of value to see how of that 20% difference that there might be questions, was it all related to profit or what caused that, what was the driver behind that difference. So we wanted to give a little more explanation as to what was behind that 20% difference. I apologize, though, for confusing the issue. That certainly wasn't our intention.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just one last quick follow-up. I guess what would be helpful to me, Sandy, would be to see the cost components, for example, the 4 of them in Figure 2, and again, presuming there's more of them. For example, somewhere out there, there's department salary and department overhead, and I'd like to see a direct comparison between those. I mean, to me, that'd be helpful to see the difference between department overhead and contract overhead and department salary and contract salary. And department profit and contract profit. I'd be interested in seeing those books. Well, I we don't know that.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, we certainly have more information on that. We'd be happy to go back and get you more details on that and provide that to you.
That would be fun. Good. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Stay on the phone, because we've got two more individuals to testify.
Just
going through. Okay,
Chair Gillen, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Department of Transportation again. Thank you for your interest in the audit and your interest in learning what we've done to address the audit. I'm going to stay away from the numbers part of the audit and talk about the learnings that we got, that the Secretary of State was able to show us the opportunities that we had to improve the way we do things. I want to set the context for this quickly. I think that from the questions you probably understand this, but just really quickly why this whole issue is of negotiation is important. Engineering consultants are selected based on quality. And once you select the best quality consultant, then you go into a negotiation. And that's what this is the whole issue is about here. What was happening in the early 2000s is we were adapting our business to deal with a larger volume than we'd ever had before. We have today $1 billion of active contracts on the street today. That's unprecedented for ODOT at any one time to have that kind of work. And we were moving quickly to be as responsive as possible to the incentives, or the increased revenues that the legislature had provided us. The audit points out some opportunities, I said, for improvement. And we saw many of those opportunities, too, and we were in process of implementing many of those opportunities. When the audit came out, we have implemented several of them, and we are in process on the rest of them. We will be ongoing work as we continue to use outside consultants. I can if you want, but I wasn't planning on going through each one of their recommendations to talk about what specifically we're doing, but suffice it to say that we agree that the audit points out outstanding opportunities for us to take advantage of more information and be aggressive in negotiation and get the best deal for the public. As Sandy noted, the audit also voiced concerns over the cost of public versus private engineering, and she noted that it doesn't take into account or it doesn't qualitatively show the difference in innovation, the difference in bringing nationally recognized experts to the table, and the cost difference, the cost to the organization, as Representative Brown pointed out, of hiring a bunch of people and then having to do something with them, either find them other work or lay them off at the conclusion of the work. And we think that those are significant costs. And I can tell you from the layoff that ODOT had in the 70s, it's a huge impact to the morale of the organization. So those things, as Sandy pointed out, those weren't included in that 20% difference, and we think that's important. I just want to summarize that we appreciate the recommendations the Secretary of State made. We appreciate the manner in which we made them, in which they made them. We were able to work with them as they were bringing the audit to fruition to understand what they were recommending, to make sure that we were as clear as possible as we step forward and hit head-on in terms of implementing their recommendations. We believe that we've made substantial progress in implementing those recommendations, and we think that we are getting to and will continue to work towards making sure that we're negotiating the best price for consultant services that we're going to continue to need to use as we work our way through the rest of the OTA packages. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, yes, Representative Greenwood.
In passing that big package, we specifically instructed you to outsource the engineering contract. If we really believed that it was 20% cheaper to do it inside, wouldn't we want to rescind that order? Would you want us to rescind that?
Chair Hillman, Representative Greenwood, I've said this to I've said this to everybody who's asked that question, including the unions.
I believe that given the environment that we were in, where we had a sudden increase in volume without an ongoing revenue stream that would support that volume, that we did the right thing by outsourcing. I think that that is the right thing to do because, and I'll go back to that layoff scenario, I think that was the worst thing that's ever happened to the Department of Transportation, was having to go through a layoff. And to add 500 or 600 engineers to do the work in this bubble without ongoing revenues and then have to face laying them off again when that work was completed would have been devastating for the department, in my opinion.
Good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one brief question. I don't know whether it's to Doug or to Sandy. We're talking about all these differences in the engineering. I'm just wondering how, and you sort of touched on it, I mean, sometimes you have to consider the value of that engineering that you're getting and really the quality of engineering and the amount of time it takes. And I don't know if that's really being accounted for here because, you know, a bad engineering job could ultimately cost a lot more, and I don't know if that's ever being considered in Sandy's audit, I suppose. Thanks.
Do you want to respond, Sandy?
Chair Gilman, Representative Holvey. With regard to the qualitative aspect, this is something that we're not able to address what those qualitative differences, if there are any, would be. So we went off of the assumption that it would be the same. We know that some of the same people probably were doing some of the work because quite a number had gone from the department over to the consultants. But, that's just something that we're just not qualified to make that kind of a determination.
Senator, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Thank you. Two short questions for Mr. Chingle. Following up on Representative Burley's earlier line of questioning, what is the age of the ODOT engineers lost during this transition period?
Chair Gilman, Senator Witzit, I'm not sure. There were some that retired and went to work for consultants, but there were also, I know some of the folks that I've worked with were still younger than I am, quite frankly, that went to work for consultants. I don't know if we have a... I'm not even sure we have a way to capture that, but there was a range of people that had retired and people that just simply chose to change their occupation to be a private consultant rather than an engineer for the government.
The second question, when we increased the amount of engineering requirements in the state by well over $1 billion, it would seem that we would expect that this supply and demand would lead to higher cost for engineering. And perhaps that's what you're seeing, and that the private sector was paying a little better salary, perhaps for that engineering, than ODOT is paying, and therefore ODOT isn't able to fill those positions as well over the same quality people.
Chair Gilman and Senator Whitsitt, I think that that may be an appropriate comment. I think that the salary compensation issue is the private sector has the ability to be a little more flexible, more quickly than the state government. But to what extent that has caused people to leave, I'm not sure.
Further questions? Thanks. Marshall?
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Kober, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. We've got about 110 members and about 3,000 employees, and we're the people that are working closely with ODOT, and I believe most of our members are the ones that are being discussed here in the audit. I'll try to be brief here. We're working closely with ODOT on the implementation of the audit findings and the significant change in the policy even before the audit was released. The national trend, as the audit says on page one, is to move away from in-house engineering staffs and move to the use of design consultants. And on TO3, definitely we took a major step in that direction, and we were primed and ready, and ready with staff and the companies ready to go to get this work done. To the audit, and I'm going to make a very brief comment here. I think there's a lot of questions that were raised here today that are good questions that we have in the industry. We put together a five-pager that I wasn't going to hand out. It's kind of an internal deal that we put together for the board, and it's got 8 or 9 bullet points on it, and under each bullet point is about 5 or 6 or 7 asterisks or dots or whatever. So, I mean, there's some questions and some comments, and there's a lot of stuff here that we have questions about the audit, and I appreciate Representative Greenleaf's line of questioning and Representative Burley. We have questions. I still don't understand the graphs on page 4, and I've been looking at it for 2 months now, so I understand a little bit better today than I did. We understand the emphasis was on the process, not on the cost. And let me go back to that point. On page 4, I think that a lot of the angst could go out of this whole thing. In my simple liberal arts mind, I'm not an engineer, with the change of one word. And at the bottom of page 4, paragraph or column 3, it talks about the cost comparisons indicate consultants were 20% more expensive. And that's a very direct, that's a statement of fact. And I think that's the headline that got picked up in the papers that ran a story on this thing. If you read them, outside consultants, you know, are 20% more expensive. And I think it gave the public the perception of the you know, $10,000 wrench and some of that kind of stuff that's gone on in some of the federal programs over the years. I don't think that's the case. But if you read it, you get down there and you're talking about 12 out of 400, and the quote, I mean, actual language, for 12 of these contracts, we compared consultant paid invoices to estimated in-house costs and concluded consultant costs were approximately 20% higher. I think if you change one word, we compared consultant paid invoices to estimated in-house costs and, instead of concluded, they concluded out of there and put in estimated, and estimated consultant costs were approximately 20% higher. I don't know if it's that good of an audit at that point. I don't know if it's a good document if you only estimate the end result, but I think that takes the cost discussion away. If you're going to make estimates on the inputs, how can you make conclusions on the outputs? I don't know.
Mark, I'm going to say that's at the bottom of page 3 of the version of the audit we have, so what you were just quoting from.
I'm sorry, bottom of page 3, you're correct. Thank you, Representative. So we consider that to be a very small sample of the number of projects that were out there and a major extrapolation of the data to get to that conclusion. And again, that was the headline that was in the paper. Again, I know the emphasis was on process, not cost, but this statement leaves a negative impression instead of what we believe was a relatively positive audit about the significant change in the key procurement method, which is going on at ODOT, and their implementation of that and our working with them and what's actually going on in the real world. Off of the report that we put together, just a couple, the role of a consultant provides value to the state, and I would think Representative Colby hit on that. ODOT was challenged to accomplish $3 billion worth of transportation projects in a short time frame. To quickly recognize and retrain employees to handle a new way of doing business was very difficult. I think Doug hit on that. To provide jobs for Oregonians. And I was part of the discussion and the debate in 03 during this. And I have said many times, I think several legislators voted for this package to fix bridges. Several voted to put people back to work. And if you remember, we led the country in unemployment at the time. And so there's other people, maybe in Redmond and Prineville, voted to get trucks off of Main Street. So there were different motivations, as there is in any significant piece of legislation, why people vote for it. But putting people back to work, I think, was a major deal at that time. And then to create a more business-friendly business climate. The audit did not address a key issue that design costs amount to 1% of the project lifecycle cost, and that investment in design costs can yield reduction in the remaining 99% of the project lifecycle costs. And a couple people here have mentioned innovation. You can innovate on the front end. You're going to save money throughout the life cycle in a building, in a water treatment facility, in a bridge, in a roadbed, anything you can do. You can have lower maintenance, lower upkeep, lower just ongoing costs that happen. We've been working closely with ODOT over the past 2 years to implement cost strategies to more effectively deliver the program, and we believe we are collaborating very effectively with the department to deliver efficient designs. And it was mentioned here, one of the main reasons to use a consultant is that when the project is complete, we go home. And we're done and we're off the project. A key point to this whole thing, I believe, is that Oregon law, it requires what was referred to as quality qualification-based selection, QBS. And we had some legislation on that last time. But it's been the law for the federal government for the last 40 years to hire engineers, design consultants, so engineers and architects and land surveyors based upon QBS, which is you create a a project overview, and then you people respond to that, and you create a short list, and you take the number one ranked firm, and you begin a negotiation with them. So there is, we passed that law in 1997. That all state agencies are required to do that. But if you have any federal money in Oregon at any level of government, today you're required to do that. And then, so when you look at the first page of the audit the end of sentence one, the purpose of our audit was to determine, and it ends up by saying, methods of obtaining design engineering services for projects has resulted in the lowest possible cost to the state. I just want to leave you with the idea that we are not rocks and gravel final construction. You can bid. You do not. The policy of the state of Oregon is to not low bid the design portion of a construction project. And that's. I just want to leave you with that. That we're not looking for the low bid designer. If you get the low bid designer, you're going to have a lot of trouble, and it's been well documented in a lot of jurisdictions in the federal government over the years. You get change orders, you get litigation, you get problems. The design or the actual contractors would much prefer to work with a qualified firm than a low bid firm. Where was I? QBS does not attempt to hire based on lowest cost but on greatest value, and brings the most highly qualified consultant to the table to negotiate the best scope for the money available, and that's the key. And I don't know if that word was used in the audit, the word scope, which is the extent of the project. The audit to determine the department's methods of obtaining design engineering services for projects has resulted in the lowest possible cost to the state. Again, it's not in accordance with QBS. And cheaper in-house services, if real or perceived cheaper in-house services, are not necessarily better or faster. Mr. Chair, I could go on, but I'd like to get down to the bottom line is that we're working well with ODOT. We continue, we believe, to provide good value, innovation, and on time and on budget for these projects that are going on. And to Representative Greenlee's question, and I think Sandra could answer this also, I think it's interesting that the audit does not suggest that ODOT hire a significant engineering staff and staff back up with engineering. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the process of developing the OTFI bills, 1, 2, and 3, both Representative Beyer and I spent a lot of time in discussing a lot of these issues we've heard here today, and we very definitely at that time, I speaking for myself anyway, felt that the contracting of engineering services was one way to go, certainly a very important way to go, as opposed to building up a workforce that we couldn't sustain in the project right now. And I think that this audit points out that, and that we're plowing new ground. Mm-hmm. You know, we've never done this to this extent before, and so we're, as can often happen, you're going to make some mistakes and do some things wrong, but this audit points out some things we can correct, but it also creates a lot of questions that aren't being answered. But I'm feeling I feel very comfortable with what's taking place, and there's undoubtedly some room for improvement, and I'm sure it'll happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things it's actually listed in the paragraph right above the recommendations in the audit. It's not actually technically one of the recommendations, but it talks about the loss of engineering expertise. And that could be engineering expertise serving the contract monitoring function. And that's the real concern I have, is the department's loss of expertise, is even if we continue with the exact same proportion of outsourcing contracts to our private engineering companies, we would still need that core base, hopefully a high level of expertise, to be able to serve effectively that contract monitoring role. That's beneficial to the state. I think that's beneficial to your folks in the private sector as well. Because it's not one of the formal recommendations, it's also not something that ODOT specifically responded to as something you're doing. Could you talk to us maybe a little bit about what you all are doing to address that, what the legislature needs to do in this report to address that loss?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, irrespective of this audit, the loss of expertise has been a concern for us for quite some time. And we have a number of strategies. One is that there is now a new engineering classification that's was implemented through collective bargaining last session, and we have yet to see the results of that. Will that change the trend? The other thing that we're doing is this is kind of a start, but I've talked to Oregon State at least, and probably talked to some of the other universities about really a curriculum that, that develops people who want the oversight policy engineering role rather than the on the table or at the cab station engineering role. And I think that's a that's an important distinction. It's one of the things that I know some of the people that have left the department have left because they wanted to do the actual engineering, the hands-on engineering, and not be involved in the discussions about the policy, about what do you do about the policy. So I think that the combination of making sure that we have an appropriate compensation method to keep qualified individuals, and then making sure that we have that people understand what the work is, what the nature of the work is in the public sector in terms of overseeing and making sure that the job gets done rather than necessarily doing it yourself, are the two big things that I would say that we're doing in terms of this expertise. In terms of other expertise, we do still have a body of people that can do work. We're equipped, we believe, to do about $250 million a year in contracting because we believe that's a sustainable level based on the current revenues coming in. And we also need competent and qualified engineers there. And so some people still do work, and again, that engineering classification structure, we believe, is going to put us in a place where we can retain the qualified people that we need.
Can I just follow up on that? So in terms of the salary grid related changes that may be going on, do you have the authority within the department to do that, or is that something that requires legislation?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, that's the salary structure, because we're in classifications that are broad statewide classifications, at least at the management level, is controlled by the Department of Administrative Services. The legislative role in that is that I think the collective bargaining is recommended by the governor and approved. The total amount of increase is recommended by the governor and approved by the legislature.
I might just suggest, Mr. Chair, this might be something we want to look at going forward, as it seems like these engineers get caught in an overall salary structure that may or may not appropriately classify them. So then that the department is then in the box where they're potentially, especially looking forward, may not be able to maintain the staff, even to do the sustainable jobs, leave alone the contract monitoring jobs.
I think that would be appropriate, and we could even extend that a little further. We could talk about competition between the counties Okay, any further questions? Sandy, thank you for your information. We appreciate the hard work. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Kelly Taylor. Dan Lovelady. Dave Burrows. And who's the customer you got with you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater. I'm with ODOT. I'm the Rail Division Administrator. And I just want to give you just a little bit of oversight of, overview, of the rail issues in Oregon. Oregon is... First, I just want to touch. We talked about a little bit earlier. I heard people talking about Main Street and how the Main Street became the highway and the cities grew up around it. Well, that's exactly what happened with this country with railroads. As America grew towards the west, it was the railroads that opened up the country to everyone. And people wanted their towns to be on rail lines because it ensured their prosperity. In fact, there are documented cases of when the rail lines bypassed the town, overnight the town would pack up and move over and tuck itself down on the rail line to be near it. And I get calls from people today who think, gosh, I really don't like that train going through my town. Could we just move that train now? So it's very interesting among the modes of transportation, the similarities, and you'll hear some other similarities in my testimony. But railroads truly do play part of our economic development, our sustainability, moving the goods that we produce in this state out of our state to the market, and bringing goods into our state. We're served by, and I put on the back of my testimony, a copy of the board and map with the rail lines. And when you overlay this and then look at the highways and things, it always reminds me of the circulatory system, you know, feeding the body of the state. We have 23 railroads in the state. We have two of the class ones, and I've got the definition on there. Basically, it's revenue and miles of track that you operate that separates the class ones, the big guys, the Union Pacific and Burlington Northerns, from the short lines that have lower revenue and less track to operate. But within Oregon, the 2,400 miles of track that we have, it's half and half, with the short lines actually operating a little bit more than the two class ones put together. But that just sort of shows you where the rail lines are. Now, as far as how it plays a part in our moving goods, almost half of our wood products and lumber and paper are moved by rail. And that's a big, big part of it. Agriculture also is a huge user of rail. And rail does help protect the roads, et cetera, because a rail car can hold equal to 3 and 4 trucks worth of product. So it does make sense. And my point is not that one's better than the other, because it's not. Each mode plays a part. And it's just that no one mode can do it all. And so each one has its niche. And to me, it's a little also like a relay race and handing the baton off between the modes. So I don't think one's better than the other. I just think they each have their own part to play. Now, the issues I want to just touch on real briefly, because I know we're running behind, so I'm just going to touch on briefly, is track infrastructure and bridge condition, something similar to highways, which you've all talked about, and congestion, something also similar to highways. Now, in the 1990s, the rail car that was being built is now what is called a 286. 286,000 pounds is what it can carry. And it's a lot like trucks, where the trailers get bigger and longer and the trucks get heavier over the years. Rail cars have gotten heavier over the years. And the track that is needed to support what is called 286 in some parts of our state is not heavy enough. Track is categorized by 3 foot lengths of track, how much it actually weighs. And to safely and efficiently move 286 cars, you need at least 110-pound rail, a 3-foot swath, preferably 130. And about 20% of our track is not that way in the state. It does not handle 286 efficiently nor safely. And so that is one of the issues, is bringing up our rail infrastructure. In fact, we have some rail in this state that was laid in 1879 over there in the Willamette Valley. So I think we've gotten our money's worth out of that particular section of track, but they do need to be replaced. It's expensive. Steel prices have gone up. I've got in here that it takes like $250,000 to $300,000 to replace a mile. So it's expensive. That includes your ties and your ballast. So, 286 is an issue. Pardon me?
What was that dollar figure per mile?
It's 250 to 300,000. I've got it in here. It's either on the second page or the third page. I've got it in here. Yes, it's on page 3 under rail funding. 250 to 300,000 per mile to upgrade it to handle 286. And about 500 miles are out there. About 20% of our rail out there does not handle 286. The other thing is...
Just quickly, though, the 500 miles that cannot handle 286, is that class one or is that short line?
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, it's short lines.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Doug loves this question.
Chair Gilman, members of this committee, again, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Department of Transportation, wishing I would have walked out the door. Representative Gilman, Representative Greenberg, it's not that I don't want to answer your question, it's just it's an incredibly difficult question to answer. The where on the numbers that Kelly's been talking about, you're talking about the cost of upgrade where you own the right-of-way. Currently, the cost to put in a mile of road varies dramatically depending on the geometry of the area that you're in, or the geometry of the roadway that you're putting in, and whether or not you have to acquire right-of-way, and a number of factors like that. So it can be as low as probably around $1 million a mile. Maybe even out here, I think Judge Cooper said that they built
by his accounting, they built that road from Pineville down to US 20 for $4 or $5 million. I think was what Judge Cooper indicated. So there's a number of it's difficult to compare the two, and there's a number of factors in the cost of building a road that make that a difficult question to answer. Sorry.
So basically, capacity to handle heavier cars is one of the issues. Another issue is bridge condition. There are hundreds of rail bridges in Oregon. These second and third generation bridges were built in the 40s and 50s, but they were built with timber trestles, so you can imagine they're aging. And the problem that is different between now, between road bridges that are aging and rail bridges that are aging, is road bridges we've got a pretty good inventory on as far as statewide. Rail bridges we don't. Certainly the railroads have information about their bridges, but it's not like anyone's out there really doing an inventory as much as we've done with the roads. And the other difference is, if a rail bridge fails, it's very difficult to detour traffic. You can't just go onto a different road because there may not be another rail to be there to go onto. So rail bridges is something that we do need to get our arms around as well. And then the last thing is, that's very similar to the roads, is congestion. There was a study done, a very extensive study back in 2003. The railroads participated with their information, et cetera, looking at the Portland-Vancouver triangle. And we're in Pineville, so you think, well, gosh, if that's a problem in Portland, it probably doesn't affect us. But actually, it does affect the whole state because so much of the traffic, north, southbound, east, westbound, go through that area. And so a congestion problem in the Portland-Vancouver area for rail harms everyone. And interestingly enough, that study showed, now Chicago in the rail world is known infamously for its congestion problems. Portland has a fourth of the traffic and already half of the congestion. So proportionally, if you were to go up and equal it, it's twice as congested as Chicago. And that study showed which fixes, solutions are needed to relieve the congestion for short term, meaning that maybe over the next 10 to 15 years those fixes would hold you, given the growth that's projected. And I bring this up just to say it's not just that Portland, Vancouver has congestion. Other parts of the state have congestion as well, because the rail system, as I pointed out, has been there for a long time, but there hasn't been lots of new rail lately. In fact, we lose rail, we don't use the gain rail. And it's my folks in the office tell me that, you know, it's almost like endangered species. You don't get rail corridors back once they pull them up. So you really have to protect your infrastructure because we're not adding rail corridors. Now, the one thing I wanted to also touch on the issue, because I've talked about the 286 issue, the fact that we need to upgrade to help the short lines out that have their customers out there that can't fill up the cars to capacity or handle the cars that are coming through, have to move them very, very slowly. That affects their productivity. I've talked about the rail bridges, and I've talked about the congestion, and that's rail funding. And you all have recognized and have contributed towards some funding towards helping the rail. And that's been a conversation we've had to have about, should the public invest in private infrastructure? In what reasons? Why would you? In what situations? Not all situations. And to what degree? It wasn't always the same mix. The 2001 and 2003 legislature gave a little bit of money, $2 million each year, just to short lines, to do some rehabilitation. It was hugely beneficial. It helped. In the 03 session, you also passed $8 million of lottery-backed bonds to do rail spurs to help connect up to businesses to be able to ship out by rail. That $8 million is all over the state. Projects are going on. Some are done. Some are in the middle of it. Some are just starting. But they will support or create several hundred jobs off that $8 million that you spent on the rail spurs. And then, of course, Connect Oregon. And I want to tell you that the nine committees, the five acts, the four modal committees are done and are now we're heading to a consensus committee to take the nine lists and put it into one. But my rail advisory committee met, and in this region, the number one rail project that we put forth is the one that the Pineville Railroad had applied for to build an intermodal hub. It actually can be phased, and that was something we recommended, that we do a first phase. And our recommendation coming to the consensus committee is that it'd be a total of $3 million, $2 million from Connect Oregon and $1 million match to build an intermodal hub. And why is that important here? Well, as the first panel was talking about, we had a workshop here with the OTC and everybody and all the local officials talking about this area and its growth. An intermodal hub in Central Oregon would hugely serve the transportation needs and help get some of that congestion off the roads and make it a place to build, and the trains and the short line can do that so that the Class 1 can do what they do best, which is hook and haul and move it out of the state, but not just go through, hook and haul it after it's been built. And so I think that's a really important one. The second one on this list for this region is the Hinkle Yard up in the Hermiston area, because that's Union Pacific's yard, and that's a big bottleneck. In fact, there are trains that wait in Idaho and further east waiting for Hinkle to clear out so they can get to Oregon. So that's my point when I bring up things about Portland or Vancouver. It really does make a difference. It's not just what's in your backyard. It's in all of our backyard what makes the difference. And for funding, our two states on either side of us, California and Washington, are investing heavily in rail. And my concern is they're going to have two fire hoses hooked up to Oregon's little garden hose, and we're going to have a problem. And so I've had members ask me, what are other states doing? And I just want you to know I've been checking around with different states to see what sort of funding ideas they came up with. And I'd be happy to talk to you about them. And some you may like and some you may not. Heck, you may not like any of them. But we can certainly talk about what other states are doing to see if it will work here, or maybe tweak it to see if it will work here. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, thank you for your presentation. I just find this fascinating. I'm very supportive of rail transport. And you mentioned we're losing rail lines, and I'm just as you said that, I'm aware that I've lived in Milwaukee for over 40 years, and we've lost two lines there. How does that happen, and why?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, well, when a rail line isn't profitable, and the thing about rail is it's a very capital expensive business to be in, and in my testimony I showed that the revenue that they spend, the percentage of revenue that railroading takes is about 18%. Capital expenditure represents 18% of the revenues, compared to 3 and 4% for many other industries. So it's a very expensive business to be in because of the infrastructure costs and the capital expenditures. And so if business, you know, I think the pendulum swung in this country. Rail opened up this country and was huge and helped. But then when we went to automobiles and trucks and planes and things, we moved away from rail. And we got it very independent and wanted to do things quicker by trucking things. And again, they have their place, but when a rail line business starts falling down and they can't make, and the two fellows next to me can speak this way better than I can, they have to look at it and say, can we keep this going, or is it costing us money to keep it going? And they'll shut a rail line down and move to abandon it. Now, they can't just close it like a dry cleaner's. You can't just put up the close sign and lock the door. You have to go through a federal board and everything showing that why you're going to abandon it and what you need to do. And we try not to have that happen because we don't want to lose rail lines. And frankly, the railroads don't want to have to go. It's just that if it becomes too expensive and there's not enough business there, that's what they have to do.
Yeah, that's all off on a different topic. Are you going to be talking at all about passenger rail?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tornay, not at this particular time, I know. But I'd be happy to talk to you tonight about it because I'll be around.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in addition to your comment there, I think that, you know, in Oregon, we've changed from where we had a sawmill essentially in every small town throughout Oregon, and whenever you close those sawmills, they no longer needed those freight cars to move that lumber in and out of those towns.
Absolutely.
And that's had a huge, it just, of course, didn't play a role so much in Milwaukee, but around the rest of the state, that played a huge role in the decline of the short line railroad.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, thank you, Chairman Gilman, committee members. I'm Dan Lovelady, General Manager of the City of Pine Grove Railway. Kelly said most of what I'm going to say, so I think she read my presentation. But anyway, I'll try not to duplicate a lot of what she said. First, a little bit about myself. I've been in the railroad business for 37 years. All the short line railroads, and most recently before coming to Prineville, I managed the Central Oregon and Pacific Short Line Railroad, which runs along the I-5 corridor from Ashland to Eugene and then from Eugene down to Coos Bay. Anyway, I'd like to give you a little history about the city of Prineville. When the first railroad was built through Central Oregon in 1910, Prineville was bypassed. So the citizens of Prineville decided to build their own railroad. And in 1918, they completed an 18-mile railroad to connect to the main railroad in Redmond. And at one time, there were five sawmills operating in Prineville. And they used the City of Prineville Railroad to ship their product. In 1971, the City of Prineville Railroad handled over 10,000 carloads. Then by the mid-1990s, all the sawmills had closed down, and the railroad traffic dwindled down to only 87 carloads for the entire year of 2004. And it was at that time that the railroad in the City of Prineville, in an effort to put more traffic on the railway, established a freight reload and storage center, and we call it the Prineville Freight Depot. The city also understood the importance for a small town like Prineville to have railway service if they're ever going to attract industry to their city. The Prineville Freight Depot, or Reload Center, has been very successful, and we expect that this year they're going to put nearly 450 loads on the City of Prineville railway. In addition, they also have been able to help non-rail-served customers like Louisiana Pacific from Burns or Malheur Lumber from John Day connect to the national rail system. Louisiana Pacific, for example, has saved over $120,000 a year in their freight costs since they started using our Prineville Freight Depot.
Mr.
Chair,
may I ask a question? Could you explain to us how they made those savings?
Instead of having to pay to truck their product all the way to destination, they truck it to Prineville, they translate it on rail, and then they enjoy the cheaper rail rates. Another example of how rail can benefit our area is a company called Ethelblock from Denver. They recently shipped a truckload of specialized block from Mexico up to Bend at a cost of $6,000 for one truckload. Shortly thereafter, they shipped a carload of the same block, which was equivalent, as Kelly said, to three truckloads for $4,200. So you can see the savings in using rail. At the City of Prineville Railway, we expect to handle from the 87 carloads in 2004, we expect to handle over 1,200 carloads in fiscal year 06-07. And in addition to that, we are working with a trust-building company that's relocating into Prineville, and also a fuel company that wants to bring biofuel mix into Prineville. So with any luck, we could exceed 2,000 carloads in our next fiscal year. One of the topics I was asked to talk on today is the freight growth and rail potential. With the growth occurring in Central Oregon, the need for reliable, affordable transportation and distribution services is going to be vital. And railroads are a critical part of that economic growth and development that sometimes get overlooked. A reality for freight shippers today is that high fuel costs and congestions on our highways are making it more and more difficult and more costly to use trucks for transport of freight. As Kelly said, and I'm repeating this, it's important that one rail car can hold the equivalent of three to three and a half trucks, depending on the commodity. More transportation buyers are looking for opportunities so they can transload onto rail and enjoy those cost benefits of using rail without investing in infrastructure or in personnel by using the transport system. And I think multimodal transportation hubs, similar to the Prineville Freight Depot, fill those needs. As we plan for future growth, we cannot overlook providing areas for industry with multimodal, both truck and rail access. properly planned, these areas can be located so they don't interfere with residential or retail growth. And they're not going to always be able to depend on the construction and service industries to provide jobs for our community. We need to position ourselves to attract industry to bring income family wage jobs. For these industries, transportation services are going to be vital. Another topic I was asked to talk about is how can rail help with Oregon's anticipated freight growth? Well, rail's going to have a huge part in Oregon's future transportation growth. But right now, we have a major problem. And I've got the BN sitting here next to me, and they have Class 1 railroad. But Class 1 railroads are getting more and more difficult to deal with. Since deregulation in 1980, railroads have been very successful to the point that they're nearing capacity. Competitive rail rates, equipment supply, and consistent transit time are issues for anyone wanting to ship by rail. Since 1980, through mergers, the number of railroads, as Class 1 railroads, has been reduced from 40 down to 7. This has, in some areas, reduced competition and has not always resulted in best benefits for the customer, especially in rural areas. In a recent railroad magazine, there was a quote from Jay O'Neill, who's the president of O'Neill Commodity Consulting, and I think it sums it up pretty well. He says it all boils down to capacity and velocity. The railroad system is clogging up, and when you have other commodities that generate higher revenues, the pressures of being a for-profit, stockholder-owned corporation are going to force you to serve your most profitable customers first. A lack of capacity on the railroads leads to service failures and cost increases as traffic competes for available capacity. The solution rests on more track capacity, more motive power, and more crew. It is in the best interest of the nation and the railroads to resolve this problem. So what can we do until the railroads solve these problems? I think we have to understand the Class 1's business models and adapt our freight shipping to fit within those business models. As Kelly said, Class 1 railroads' goals are to haul large volumes of freight for long distances, what they call hook and haul. They develop their schedules and rate structures around the needs of their prime customers who ship in large volumes. They operate on rigid schedules which customers must adapt to. They have no interest in stopping on their main line to switch out a small or a medium customer. In contrast, short line railroads' business models are much different. We can adapt our service to meet our customer needs, and we're more than happy to switch out a customer, even if it's only for one carload. Multimodal freight hubs, similar to the Prineville freight depot, are the future of economic growth in Oregon. As I mentioned before, they can be located in areas where they don't interfere with the growth of residences and retail. And they can also meet the needs of the Class 1 railroads by giving them big blocks of cars that interchange if they're located on a Class 1 railroad, or by only requiring the large railroad to stop one time to set out and pick up if they're located on the main line. Multimodal hubs can also result in more favorable pricing and better service to smaller shippers because of the consolidation of the volume. The Port of Portland has also recognized this need, and they are in the process of developing multimodal hubs similar to the Prineville Freight Depot in both Medford and Holmes. We believe here in Central Oregon that because we have a short line railroad and our freight distribution center that we are well positioned to handle Central Oregon's freight growth in the future. Not many people realize that there's only two north-south railroads west of the Mississippi, and one of them is in Oregon. There's no doubt that the Oregon trunk line that operates or runs from the Dalles down to Klamath Falls is going to handle a lot more trains and a lot more rail cars in the future. And unfortunately, most of that traffic is not going to originate or terminate in Oregon. Most of it's going to be from Canada or Washington or the ports, overheading over the line down to California and Arizona. There's estimates that there's 19.5 million tons of rail freight that either originate or terminate in Central Oregon. This equates to over 700,000 truckloads, and not a lot of it moves on rail. Why doesn't it move on rail? Here's an example. Of that tonnage, approximately 14,000 containers come into Seattle, Tacoma, the ports. They're put on rail down to Portland, unloaded and put on trucks to move into Central Oregon. And we've negotiated with one of the large Class 1 carriers to see how we can keep those containers on rail into Central Oregon. And their answer to us is, if you can develop enough containers for a whole train, we'll consider it. But if you can't, then we won't consider it. And a full train is 235 to 250 containers at a time. And we just don't have the volume for that. And they won't consider adding containers onto a mixed freight train or a merchandise train. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have more traffic on the rail. When these containers are unloaded, most of them return empty back to the ports. But if we could figure out a way to put these containers on rail, we could take nearly 30,000 trucks off of our streets and highways between Portland and Central Oregon. And if we build and operate our multimodal facilities and make them efficient, and get more traffic on rail, we can take a heck of a lot more trucks on normal. That would save a lot of precious taxpayer highway dollars if we could do so. In summary, small railroads and small shippers cannot continue to do business the way they once did. We have to understand how to adapt to the changing transportation environment. And I would also like to mention Connect Oregon and praise our legislator for having the vision to provide funding to enable multimodal opportunities other than highways to encourage the development of transportation alternatives. This is the kind of progressive action that will help Oregon solve its transportation needs in the future. And as Kelly mentioned, we submitted a project to Connect Oregon to enlarge and improve our freight depot multimodal facility, and we have our fingers crossed that we're going to be selected for funding. Anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but just a quick comment, Mr. Mulberry. I want to commend you for the excellent work you've done with the prime building for the railroad here at the short line. I think that the last mill that shut down here in Prineville was Ochoa Lumber, just down the road here, and that was, what, 3-4 years ago in that area. And the railroad just about went completely out of business. In fact, I think probably what kept it afloat was the city kicked in some money, and John Shelton might kicked in some money just to keep the thing going for them. You've done a great job. Your business, your freight's increasing now, and I fully support your projects, even though I haven't submitted a letter on behalf of your project. That was a great idea. Success in getting that grant awarded.
Thank you very much. Further questions, comments?
Thanks. Dave, I guess you're next.
Between Dan and the customer, it may be a long day. but I'm up for it.
Kelly's told you a lot of the background that I was going to talk to you about. There's two Class 1 railroads here. The Union Pacific is the largest of the two in Oregon. We're the largest. Really, Santa Fe is the largest in Washington because it's our line that runs between Seattle and Vancouver, and then it switches over to theirs. We come down the north side of the Columbia River and cross and come up to Deschutes Canyon, what is known as the Oregon Trunk. And I will just say parenthetically, because Kelly talked about the costs and the expenses, we just finished a project on the Oregon Trunk in which we replaced a lot of the rail and put in concrete ties rather than wood ties, which are very helpful in handling the heavier cars. And they obviously last longer, but they're very expensive. And the project was somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 million. It is a very, very capital-intensive business. That's just maintaining. I mean, we didn't add anything. We just fixed what we had to make it better. We've been operating in Oregon since 1883. About 500 employees, $23 million payroll. And I do think there is something you do need to understand. We do have between 375 and 400,000 car loadings in Oregon every year. We're not just a pass-through railroad. A lot of what we do is pass-through. No question about it. Dan's absolutely right about that. But we also add cars, a lot of cars, in Oregon. Now, we do have a big intermodal facility in Portland. That accounts for some of this. But I want to assure you, in talking to the people at the company, they have the same reaction Representative Burley did about the Pineville freight depot, and that is that it's just that kind of operation is the wave of the future. We cannot stop the trains on the main line every 20 minutes and put a car on. It just doesn't work. We're putting more trains on the Oregon Trunk every year. And moving, keeping them moving is critically important. And then we also have the issue of, which I'll get to in a minute, of we have to have some windows so people can get on the line to maintain it. We just can't train it rolling by every 20 minutes because the maintenance people have to get on the line to work on it. So, Burlington Northern has nothing but the highest praise for the Prineville project. We've gotten more business from the Prineville Railroad. We see it as a good partnership. Obviously, there are issues, and I think there always will be, I guess, to some extent. I want to take, if I can, just one moment to disagree with Kelly. Certainly, rail and trucks are both needed on the surface transportation system, but they are not equally good. Rail is the safest, most energy efficient, most environmentally friendly, and certainly in the case of longer distances, the most cost-effective surface transportation system available. Dan talked about that. It's cheaper to send it by rail, not for 30 miles, but for longer distances, no doubt, no question about it. And I don't even want to get into the issue of traffic congestion and problems that, and the truckers are having their problems too, with shorter work hours and all those things. A number of other things I wanted to talk about, Kelly's already covered. I do want to talk a little, just for a second, if I may, before I get to the other thing that Janet asked me to talk about, and that is our safety record. We are very, very proud of this. We consider ourselves one of the safest, if not the safest, Class 1 railroad in America. And I say that because the standard that we use, and I think it's the standard of the industry, is how many safety incidents do you have per 200,000 work hours? And in the early 1990s, we were running at about 9 safety incidents for every 200,000 work hours. We are now down, even with more employees, more trains, more activity, more things going on, we're down to 1.3 safety incidents for 200,000 hours. So we think we've made great progress on that. Now, I'll be very brief about this, and I'll condense this down, but Janet asked me to talk also about challenges that railroads face. And obviously, one of the demands we have is capacity. We are a growing business. We've had significant growth in all our business units, coal, agriculture, intermodal, industrial products. And we believe that the future holds additional growth for rail. And this puts increasing pressure on key infrastructure checkpoints. We, as an example, have a problem. We cannot double load intermodal containers because we have tunnels that we go through going south. They're too low. So we bring them through a single layer, run them all the way to Long Beach. Then they double load them and send it all the way to Chicago and then back to Seattle. So they say, well, gee, that's pretty inefficient. You're right. We would love to have the cap to have the capital and convince Fort Worth that they ought to spend the money to raise the lid on the tunnels. They have to figure out whether that's cost effective. Every decision in that regard is determined by whether or not it's cost effective. And again, we also have to maintain the maintenance windows to ensure that we're running a safe, efficient railroad. The private financing, and Kelly talked about this, is very, we spend a lot of the revenues that the railroad receives, 18% in the case of the industry as a whole, on infrastructure maintenance and development. We will spend $2.5 billion this year to fund 400 new energy efficient and lower emission locomotives. And we also have to maintain 33,000 miles of track, and we have to increase capacity. That means new sidings, longer sidings. Trains have gotten longer. We interact with Amtrak, and we have to go off to the siding as they come through, and that's fine. We're not unhappy about that. But that, if the trains get longer, we've got to have longer sidings. Those are expensive. And because we finance our own capital investments, sometimes our priorities might not perfectly align with those of the state or the region. Just don't always do it. Last item is the issue of safety, and I've talked about our employee safety, but I want to talk about other safety for just a second. Some citizens, again, become complacent and impatient with train operations. They don't like trains coming through their town. They try to beat the arms. They ignore the bells and whistles. And that's a great concern. We have a whole, the industry as a whole has a whole program on safety issues, and some of you will remember how strongly and passionately Everett Cutter from the Oregon Railroad Association felt about that, Operation Lifesaver, and they put a lot of money into that program alone. And I'm sure we're going to have a question or two about crossing before the day's out. If my ears didn't play tricks on me earlier. Sometimes we have kind of public reactions to things, and they say, well, there was a chlorine gas tanker car incident in Graniteville, North Carolina, that led to a number of people suggesting that all hazardous material should be shipped by truck. Even though we would say that rail is 16 times safer than truck. But that's something, you know, people react, and then we're trying to stomp out the fire. One of the things some of you may have, I'm sure, have heard about, and some others may not have, there is a movement in the rail industry, especially in the Class 1s, to use remote-controlled locomotives, where people stand on the ground and actually in the yard where they build the trains, not running the trains down the line. You know, we don't do that from Fort Worth, some guy watching a console. But in the yards where they're building the trains, they have found that as much as Canada's been doing this for a long, long time, and have found that their incident of injuries in the yards when they're building the trains has been reduced about 40%. That's one of the more dangerous parts of the whole business. signal, hand signals, and sometimes they, you know, they're talking on the walkie-talkies and they don't, they get jammed up and they can't hear very well. And so the building of the trains is a tricky part. A lot of people say remote control. Oh my, you know, they think it's a little, running a little race car around, you know, like your grandchildren do. On some places, children. So I just wanted to mention that to you in case somebody mentioned, you know, says that that's a terrible problem. It is not. It's a great solution to a severe problem. Our railroad and all the railroads and short lines and class ones are all continuing to focus heavily on employee safety and public safety. It is a big mantra for our company, and I know it is for the others. I'm not saying we're better than they are, but we're certainly focused on it heavily, and our commitment to you is that we will continue to have a heavy focus on that.
Brief question. Dave, can you talk a little bit about the role of the unit train and how that affects
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I'm sorry, what was the first group?
The unit train.
The unit train. It is a factor in the world. Something I didn't realize until recently. Some of you know that Tom Barrows and I represent a large potato farm and dairy operation in the Borden area. And on that, what used to be the Boeing Space Age Industrial Park, now deeded down in the corner, is the PGE plant, which is the coal-fired plant. Our railroad, which even though we don't operate in that part of the state, we bring unit trains in there three times a week with coal from Wyoming. It is a very efficient way to quote, run the railroad. They put coal on 150 cars in Wyoming, and they haul it to Borden. It is very cost-effective. There's no question about it.
Is that taking up a lot of the capacity now in the various lines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenland, most of our trains in this part of the country are not unit trains. They are mixed trains. You got lumber and some. I would say most of the unit trains certainly are heavily in the area of automobile transportation. But most of the trains are not just all warehouse or lumber or something like that.
Okay. I'm Bud Prince. I manage Redmond Economic Development Corporation in Redmond, and I was asked to participate as sort of the end user of the rail system, and one of the things that didn't last is that most of your topics are covered, so I'm going to have to go over all that ground again. But I do want to share with you some observations from that end user point, because in Redmond we're facing serious problems. In talking to Burlington Northern in particular, they no longer want to serve local customers in Redmond. And so we're working around it. But we all realize that all the things that we said, the rail service is certainly an asset, and it's a necessary resource if we're going to continue to grow the economy in our area. And with diesel fuel prices going up, more and more people want to get out of trucks and get on the rail system. So that's the direction we want to go. But the challenge we have is how do we get delivery in Redmond? We're working with Dave and the Prineville system, and we think there's some real potential there, especially up at the Union Junction up in the city. There's some complications there in terms of available land use, and perhaps we may need some exceptions to be able to have enough room to put in long enough spurs to be able to make it worthwhile again to deliver enough cars to where the main line will stop and service the area. But at this stage of the game, we're really in a pickle because we don't have an opportunity to serve additional customers. And that's sort of the fact of life. We have an example for what was said before. Due to the reroute of Highway 97, one of our natural propane gas suppliers has been taking delivery by truck. And through a nice grant, we were able to help fund a new spur to be built. But that's turned into be a big challenge, and it's been almost 2 years now since that was started. And we still don't have that spur in place, but that will take propane tanker trucks off the highway, which would, again, follow the safety point, much safer to be on the river. So there are some challenges and there are some problems as the end user. I don't have the answers in total. I think we're trying to work through some of the issues with the benefit of the Prineville Railroad, I think. The concerns are statements where we've got companies that have asked the railroad for service, and their answer is, well, just go to Prineville. But the company doesn't want to be in Prineville. They'd rather be in Redmond because that's in the center of their customer service area, and they'd still end up putting the freight on a truck and hauling it 20 miles back across to Redmond when we have a railroad running right through the middle of Redmond. Another concern is the transition that we're undergoing is that we have team tracks in Redmond. I don't know if you're familiar with team tracks, but it's a spur and a siding that's owned by the railroad, where they'll schedule a delivered freight car for the company then to meet and unload during that particular day, and then they come and pick up the car and haul it away the next day. That's serving several of our customers, and I'm working with one very large company that is pretty much counting on that, yet that's a possibility that that'll no longer be available if we continue down the direction we're going with eliminating the local drop-offs where only large quantities of cars can be distributed in the area. And I think probably the city of Bend is facing the same consequences. So how we're going to get beyond this, I don't have all the answers. Obviously, if it was an easy answer, we'd have solved the problem a long time ago. But I understand where the railroad's coming from. They're sort of, again, between a rock and a hard place. They need to get the big trains from Portland to Oakland, and they don't want to stop in Redmond or Bend or the Pine or anyone else along the line because that's not the most efficient way to operate the railroad. So it looks like the solution is going to be through some short line operation. And so the question is then, how do we efficiently do that and not have to haul everything to Prineville and backhaul it back to the river? So I guess that's my whiner list for the day. I apologize for being so direct about it, but it is a major component. It's only going to get bigger in terms of customer requirements and customers from my standpoint. Just ironically this morning, I was talking to another company that's pretty serious about putting their plant in Redmond, and the first question was, you got a railroad service here, don't you? And I have to tell them I did. I said, well, I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, the railroad will not deliver any more cars to Redmond for a customer like you. If you're not a big user, then you're not going to be able to offer that service. And so that's a terrible thing to have to say. But I said it again, and I don't want to say it again if we come up with a solution. I think hopefully working with Prineville Railroad, and if we can work out some arrangement in working with the city, that might help. We have another opportunity through a large land swap or sale from DLN to the Department of State Lands at the south end of the city, looking at about 900 acres there that's involved in a whole other issue. That a possibility would be that we could put a rail spur off the main line to serve that area because it's sort of off the end of the runway. You're not going to want to build a lot of houses there, so it's probably going to be industrial property or commercial property. So there may be a longer term, not a future solution. I have two independent resources, individuals in Redmond that have approached me about being able to provide a terminal, not necessarily be in competition with the one in Prineville, but they've recognized the value and need of having local delivery, and in particular, containers. One of our customers is QYM USA. That's a Korean company that assembles in Redmond tractors that are mostly manufactured, put in containers, shipped over here. takes 11 days for that to get from Korea to Tacoma. It typically takes up to 30 days to get it from Tacoma to Redmond. And that's not very good service. And that's the other thing, then, that I'm running into is that the delivery service, the reliability, is so poor that a lot of the industrial customers would like to use the railroad, but they've had bad experiences, and I'm sure that things are improving, but in the past, they've lost cars or they've been so late that they end up with some real serious servicing problems for their own business, and so they're not interested. And we've got a couple of them right here that have been in Central Oregon for some time that have their own trucking fleet just because they don't want to deal with the railroad. So, sorry to talk about the mainline service. Certainly not a fault as much as just an awkward situation that we're finding ourselves in due to circumstances that are probably pretty much beyond most people's control. But if we don't put our mind to fixing it, it's just going to perpetuate the problem and we're not going to be able to get a solution. Thanks for listening to my complaints, if that's a
question.
Mr. Chairman, I guess really this is just more of a comment to follow up on this at-grade crossing issue. You know, like I said earlier, we've got 11 at-grade crossings in the city of Van Nuys, and it's just not that good. Incredibly fortunate that we haven't had any serious accidents. Mayor Unger said we've got about a dozen in the city of Redmond, and one of the things that we in Central Oregon have been kind of starting to talk about now in the context of this whole U.S. 97 transportation corridor issue is that if it's going to cost us $3, $4, $5 million to separate 8 grade crossings, and we've got at least 11 in Bend, versus $2 million a mile to build some new track, why don't we just move the railroad completely out of Redmond and Bend and just deal with it all in one shot? It'd be cheaper and longer. So we're starting to have these conversations, and Dave, I don't know if you've been contacted yet, but I did give your name to one of our city councilors, and I think that, you know, I don't know if it's the right answer, I don't know if we can make it work, but it's an option that I think we need to take a look at, because, you know, we're spending a ton of money on highway work, like the Cooley Road interchange and what's going on up in Redmond, and bam, right smack in the middle of this whole thing is an at-grade crossing, and that just increased the cost. I'm hoping that when the call comes, you folks will come and help and participate in this discussion and see if there's a way that we can come up with some sort of solution.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions, if I may. I'm curious, why would it take 30 days? Can you help me understand why it would take 30 days to get from Tacoma?
The comments, again, I'm repeating what I've been told, but the main hang-up is the trucking industry doesn't like to haul containers here because they end up backhauling empty for the most part, and they have not been very diligent of being very timely, and they kind of bring them when it's convenient. Is what it comes down to.
You're talking about truckers or the train?
Truckers.
Truckers, okay.
And what we'd like to do is to put those on a train and haul them down here as a large package to deliver.
Thank you. And Kelly, this is for you. Are there federal laws regarding freight rail? Are there any, I guess what I'm getting at, is there a requirement that they provide services, or does the federal law, do they?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the Staggers Act that happened back in the 1980s deregulated rate and service. So it's mostly safety regulations now that I enforce.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Pamela. I appreciate it very much.
Sorry, we're running late.
For asking me to be here, Mr. Chair. I hope you don't mind if I keep my remarks brief. I have a cure for all these problems. It's called We Extend the Runway at Redmond, and FedEx brings a 747 and brings in all the parts, just takes care of that problem. So I just thought I'd drop that. I was asked to say a few words to you this afternoon because the director of the Department of Aviation couldn't be here, and so I wanted to tell you a little bit about what was going on in Oregon as far as aviation goes. Now, I can't say too much about PDX because their numbers are so large and everybody kind of knows what kind of part they play in aviation in Oregon, clearly without underestimating it, they are the most important airport in Oregon. They move the most people, they move the most cargo, the largest aircraft go in there, the most investment, you know, you can go on and on and on. But there are six others, and Redmond is one of them, and they are Cape Falls, North Bend, Redmond, Eugene, Pendleton, and Medford as far as commercial service airports. The state owns 30 general aviation airports throughout the state. Some of them are emergency airfields, and some of them are in communities like Bandon and others like that. And the state manages that. They also provide the infrastructure along with the FAA and any management oversight and maintenance on those airports. In the most important aviation project, in my opinion, that happened in the state last year was the new runway that opened in Eugene. That was a $25 million investment by the airport and the Federal Aviation Administration. And any time you can add a runway to a state adds aviation capacity, and that's huge. I can't underestimate that. And they probably took about 10 years to make that happen. That's how long, by the time you start it and you go through the environmental and everything else, it's about 10 years till you get that open. So that was really huge for the state. At this time, I don't think there's another runway planned at this time. They're moving the Bend runway from one side to another, but they're not increasing capacity by adding another runway in the state. So that's really huge. There are three terminals that are currently in the design phase for the state of Oregon, and that's one here in Redmond, one in Medford, and one in North Bend. And I suspect that Medford's will in total be what ours will end up being, which is in the neighborhood of about $50 million when you add the cost of parking lots, passenger as well as air, you know, car rental and others, the ramp where the aircraft park, and the terminal itself. So Medford and Redmond, probably about $100 million investment, and probably I would estimate that North Bend probably in the neighborhood of about $15 to $20 million based on their size. And those should be completed, I would suspect all of them, by 2008. So that's a major investment in the state as far as aviation goes. Some of the things that are facing at least the commercial service airports in the future are huge growth. I mean, we're showing that in Redmond, our enplanements were up, which is the number of people get on the aircraft last year, by 21%, which is huge. We just reflect the local area, and we serve all of Central Oregon. And then the other thing is the change in fleet that the air carriers are currently going through, Horizon being the most important one in the region. They serve all our commercial service airports. And the smaller airports are going to have an issue, we think, with transitioning from the 38-seat aircraft to the 76-seat aircraft. Not all airports are going to be able to handle the change, and so we're very concerned about that. And we think that'll happen. The Horizon has announced that starting next year, all those aircraft will be replaced. As far as the state goes, right now what the state is doing is a lot of planning to get us ready for the future. We think all airports have a huge economic development role to play in their community. And we need to see where we are with that, what the state's rates and charges are, and how can we help these airports grow in all the communities and show the community what value that airport has, and it's worthy of making infrastructure investments in. We also, the Oregon Airport Managers Association, as well as the Washington Airport Manager Association, got a federal grant so that we could study and help airports that want to become air carrier airports. There are a lot of communities in the state that think they would like to have air carrier service. They don't really either know how to go about it or even know what investment they are going to have to make down the road to get that, or even if
the carriers will pay attention to them. So we've gotten a grant, put together a toolkit that you can hand to some community and say, if you follow these steps, by the time you get to the end, you'll have a pretty good idea, one, what it'll cost you, is your airport there, what kind of investment you need to make, and whether the community is large enough or whatever to be able to sustain service. And we think that's very important because it's difficult now if you don't have service to get service. And we think that we need to help these communities if there's a way that we can do that. And we thought this was a very cost-effective way to do it. And the other big issue for us is land compatibility uses. People have a love-hate relationship with airports. They love it because they can get somewhere quickly. I hate it because of the noise. And so it's kind of back and forth. Yeah, it means a lot of economic development for the area, but I don't like the noise. I don't want the traffic. So those are issues that we want to deal with and work with communities as best we can on it. And please let me answer any of your questions if I can.
Sorry, I'm going to make this really short, too. But you mentioned that the Horizon moving to 76 passenger airplanes.
Correct.
Will that require, I assume that's going to require some extensions of runways or not?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. We appreciate the work you do on the Aviation Board, too.
Well, it's an honor to serve the state of Oregon. It truly is. But I know that you're all coming, I hope, to the airport, right? And I'd like to give you some choices. Not just how you get there, but when you get there, we can do a couple of different things. We have some cold drinks and some other things set up for you in a conference room, and we can just meet in there. We've got a map and some other things that we can show you're doing. We have our bus available, our emergency bus, and we can take you out on the field, and we can race airplanes down the runway and taxiways, and, you know, we can just do whatever it is you want. You don't have to make a decision now. You can make a decision when you get to the airport.
Okay, we'll go around the other side.
We can do that, too. We can do whatever you want. What I'd like you to do is when you come in and you come on the airport, remember the airport was an old military base in the 40s, and all that property, as you come into the airport, on the way to the terminal, you pass some area that's undeveloped, you pass a golf course on the right, which is not being used at this time. That is part of a huge project that we are starting within the next year that I will tell you about, but just kind of look at it and know that there's going to be something else there when you come back. I beg your pardon? Yes, please. Yeah, park in the passenger parking lot and bring your ticket with you so that we can validate it. We kind of call it get out of jail free. So bring your ticket in and we can validate it.
Okay.
You get off. Doug wanted me to tell you not to go with where the old terminal used to be. We have hangars there now. If you come on to the airport, go with 126 and just follow the signs to the airport. And as long as you can see the tower, that's the direction that you're going.
Yeah.
And you just take a left one block after the control tower.
We have to check in and get clearance.
No, you just drop my name.
126.
That might get you if the sheriff was there. I don't know.
That's before you cross Highway 97.
Yes. And if you cross Highway 97, just go south on 97 and take the airport, the entrance to the airport. Follow the tower. One block after.
The airport suite is just on the other side of 97. So it should be, I think, for the revenue service. We kind of need to know who's meeting there and who's meeting up at the training station. That's 615 at Temple Street, 630 at the training station. So if you get that down there, I'm going to get closer to the meeting.
Can I go to the airport? Oh, wait a minute.
Haven't
you signed up for public?
All good.
we just caught up.
Now, when you say meet at the train station, you're talking about the one up at O'Neill Junction there, where you load up. Okay.
What time is that? Yeah.
Next meeting is in Newport,
July 11th.
July 11th.
I hope we have as good a turnout as we've had today.
Talk to the vice chair. This meeting is adjourned.